Welcome, and we are starting this evening by, do we have a quorum? And Representative Murphy would like to move the minutes from the February 12th meeting.
So move, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 And the minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay. First up this evening, we are going to hear House File 2830, chief authored by Representative Tao, and he is at the front desk, and since he is a member of this committee, he can move his own bill, I assume.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 2837, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy. This bill is first because it's quite the least contentious. A lot of things have been worked out between the two sides. Mr. Medford will explain the bill a little bit more. Mr. Medford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Meffert. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Optometric Association, and as Representative Powell mentioned, this bill is essentially an administrative simplification bill. It does a couple of things in particular. One is to consolidate the licensing process for optometrists right now, and the other is to change from a licensure by reciprocity for those coming from other states to licensure by endorsement. That's essentially a change in semantics right now, since the process is essentially by endorsement, but in statute it says reciprocity, and so it's a change in that. In order to do that, you'll notice that the very first section changes the way that optometry is defined. This was first written in 1915, and a few things have happened since then. Throughout the licensure, or the process of adding different levels of licensure to optometry, first in the 1980s, adding a certification for using diagnostic drops, and then in the 90s, the certification to be able to use pharmaceuticals to treat conditions of the eye. Those were added on to the statute. The definition up front was never changed. This section changes that definition up front, and it takes language that currently exists in 148.576 and moves it verbatim into this part. So there's no change in what optometrists are allowed to do. There's no change in what optometrists do clinically. This is just a change to clarify in one place what optometrists do. The reason why this is necessary is we're taking those three levels of licensure and collapsing them into one. For all intents and purposes, every optometrist who's been licensed in Minnesota since, I believe, 1994, actually it predates that, but for sure since 1994, has been licensed at that top level to be able to prescribe medication. There are currently, I believe, 18 optometrists who are practicing in the state who aren't at that level. This gives them 4 years to get there, and we'll go through the steps necessary to help them get to that level. that process, again, streamlines what the optometry does in order in licensing optometrists. It says that they have one process instead of three steps. And the language in here is technical in nature to allow the board to actually do that. I don't know if we need to go line by line through that. And the other part, again, is the licensure by endorsement. It's changing from reciprocity to endorsement, like I said there. It removes the rule for reciprocity in the Minnesota rules, and so it accommodates the licensure by endorsement. And that just means that optometrists who have go through similar requirements in other states, which actually most states around us have the same licensure requirements as us. The Board of Optometry doesn't need to go to that other state and say, do we have an agreement? They can just take that on their own and apply that to that person coming in. So that's the gist of the bill. As I said, there's no change in what optometrists do. There's no scope of practice. We, in fact, and I believe our friends from the Academy of Ophthalmology will speak afterwards. We brought this to them a year ago to make sure that they knew that this wasn't a scope of practice change, and it's actually fostered the beginning of a good relationship between our organizations, and we can speak more to that. Any other questions?
Any questions from any committee members?
Madam Chair.
Sorry?
It's just always good to hear the optometrists talk like the good friends the ophthalmologists have. So
that's a good thing. Congratulations.
Very hard on that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add to that. I think it's a good thing to hear you started talking about it a year ago as well. Anybody else from the committee have a question?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Nelson, or do we call him Master Nelson? I want to hyphenate you needlessly. You have a section on here under the endorsement that talks about, and you were just addressing the transfers from other states, folks who might move into town, and you talked about some of the states surrounding have similar requirements. I guess I'm wondering, as you move away from those states in the Midwest and go out further, do you have any concerns with perhaps some states that don't have as high qualifications or the similar qualifications that we do, and how would you address that? And the other piece to that, I'll just ask now while I have the floor, is the $87 fee. Is that new, and what was the fee prior to this? Because it looks like it'll be a fee increase, and I just would like to be clear about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, the fee is the same as it is now, and there are reasons why they put the actual dollar amount that the Board of Optometry and their legal counsel, the Attorney General's Office, understand, and I'm not sure that I fully understand myself. There are 19 colleges of optometry in the country, and the closest one is in Chicago here. What that means is that the educational standards and the licensure standards for the licensure are actually very consistent from state to state. And so there are very few states that don't have that similar licensure requirements. The bigger change is actually becoming continuing education requirements, which is after licensure. But that initial licensure phase is quite consistent.
Anyone else? Okay. And Representative Powell, you have another testifier?
I think we do.
Dr. Edley?
Someone from the...
Welcome, Dr. Edley.
Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dr. Scott Utley. I am a practicing ophthalmologist in St. Paul and am president-elect of the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology. I speak today on behalf of my organization. I want to state for the record that the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology will not oppose House File 2837. Our organization is very appreciative of the Minnesota Optometric Association's willingness to maintain open lines of communication throughout the drafting of this legislative proposal. With this cooperative process, our organizations have worked together in drafting a bill that both groups could live with, and we will continue working together on future legislative proposals. I also want to state for the record that our two organizations will be working together over the summer to alleviate some concerns that our academy, the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology, has over the ambiguity of the statutory language referencing invasive surgery under the Board of Optometry statute. We plan to work with the Minnesota Optometry Association over the summer to draft a definition for invasive surgery that both of our organizations can agree upon. I want to thank you for your time. This concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone in the committee have questions for him? No? Okay.
Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Did you want to add anything, Representative Powell?
No, Madam Chair, members, this time we'll just renew the motion to send this to Health Human Service Policy.
Okay, so we're going to vote on the motion to recommend this to pass and move it to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? And it is passed. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, you have your bill before us. Why don't I move the bill? I will move House File 2399. And I believe there's a author's amendment as well. Or
yes, Mr. Chair, the A2.
The A2, does everyone have the A2? I'll also remove the A2 amendment. Go ahead, explain what that is.
If it deletes some language and adds another piece, if we could just put it on and then I can explain the bill as it stands, that would be maybe easier.
Okay, I move the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, amendment adopted. Go ahead,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill related to the statute governing athletic trainers in Minnesota. And just as a little bit of a preface, this bill did go through the process of a report by the Council of Health Boards and through their review process over the past, since the summer and into the fall. And as a result of some of those, as a result of that process, that's why some of the amendments were made here to the statute. So I'll run through the bill quickly, and then the testifier can explain a little bit more of the reasoning. The first section, Section 1, is mostly a technical change. The Council of Health Boards determined that it doesn't change the educational or training requirements for athletic trainers. And it just kind of brings things into conformance with current practice. The second change is that it removes the word athlete from the statute and replaces it with the word patient, and it removes the word athletic from the term athletic injury, so we'd be left with just the word injury. Significantly, with regard to both patient and injury, the definition of what those things are, and hence the scope of the practice of these folks, are not changed as a result. The definition of what they can do is not changed by those changes. What it really does is it reflects the reality that athletic trainers now don't work solely in stadiums and with athletic teams, but actually work in clinics where they are treating what all of us would consider to be patients of that clinic. The third thing, and I would just draw folks' attention to lines 2.32 and 3.1 and 3.2 related to a 3-month grace period. That's what we took out with the amendment, and that was one of the things that the Council of Health Board expressed some concern about. So the athletic trainers have actually taken that language out. That won't be in the bill. The fourth thing is that they're tightening up the temporary registration requirements. So instead of being allowed to be temporarily registered for a year, it will only last for 6 months. And so that what that means is they actually have to get their credentialing examination information into the board within 6 months instead of within a year. And it also changes it so that when someone is temporarily registered, they have to be under the direct supervision of another athletic trainer. And current law says that an athletic trainer can oversee 4 temporarily registered folks. This is limited to 2. So it's actually tightening up the temporary registration requirements. And the last thing that was added by the amendment is incorporating the disciplinary procedures of the Board of Medical Practice into the athletic trainer statute. So that makes it clear that they are subject to those same disciplinary rules as other professionals governed by the Board of Medical Practice. So that is kind of a summary of the bill, and I'd like to let the testifier explain a little bit more about the rationale behind it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for your time to hear this bill. First, I'd like to start off by reading a letter from the
state. State your name.
My name is Mike Doyle.
Go ahead, Mr. Doyle.
First, I'd like to start off with a letter from the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice from Robert Leach, the executive director. Regarding Athletic Trainers Bill HF 2399, to whom it may concern, the athletic trainers have been regulated by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice since 1993. Athletic trainers are healthcare professionals who work under a physician protocol and are educated to treat injuries. The Board of Medical Practice does not see the change in the terminology from athlete to patient as a concern or an expansion in their practice. The change is reflective in their client population. Other changes in the bill address appropriate public protection, including the change in the temporary registration from 1 year to 6 months and decreasing the supervision from 4 to 2, as well as adding a self-reporting mechanism and disciplinary actions that were not in the original bill. Changes in regards to the governing bodies are indicative of adoptions of our educational process. The Board of Medical Practice has no concerns with this bill. My name is Mike Doyle. I'm the president of the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association. I've been a certified athletic trainer for 17 years, and I currently practice at Alexandria Orthopedics in Alexandria, Minnesota. I'd like to thank you, thank Representative Thiessen and Representative Powell for taking the time to hear our bill and our practice act provision, F2399. The National Athletic Training, just so I'm just going to give a little bit of a history of what's transpired for athletic training. The National Athletic Training Association was founded in 1950, and athletic trainers have been recognized by the American Medical Association as allied healthcare professionals since 1991. Athletic trainers have been registered and regulated healthcare professionals in Minnesota since 1993. As our profession has evolved, our practice act has become outdated. This legislation is about updating the Practice Act to recognize the natural progression of our profession. Our proposed changes aim to update accrediting organization language, decrease temporary registration from 1 year to 6 months, restrict the number of temporary registrants that can be supervised from 2 to 4, change the term athlete to patient, and athletic injury to injury. The changes that we are proposing do not expand the scope of practice. The definitions of what injuries we treat, in addition to where and how we treat them, do not change. Directly tied to the issue of scope is reimbursement. This bill is not about reimbursement. There is currently no independent reimbursement mechanism for athletic trainers, and this bill does not contemplate such a mechanism now. Today, athletic trainers are the only allied healthcare professional identified by who we serve, not what we do. The goal of this legislation is to clarify who we are, who we treat, and where we treat our patients. The term patient is already used in numerous times in our existing Athletic Training Practice Act. In Chapter 148.7807, it states, if an athletic trainer determines that a patient's medical condition is beyond the scope of practice of the athletic trainer must refer the patient to a person licensed in the state of Minnesota to practice medicine. Later on, it continues to state an athletic trainer shall modify or terminate treatment of a patient that is not beneficial to the patient or that is not tolerated by the patient. We have amended our original bill to remove the 90-day grace period allowing the practice without assigned protocols from after the discussion with the Council of Health Boards and Occupational Review Panel, and our colleagues in other healthcare industries. It was agreed that this provision would not serve the best interest of the public. In addition, after numerous meetings and discussions, the review panel and fellow healthcare providers, the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association, agreed to add language holding our profession to the same disciplinary reporting requirements put forth by the Board of Medical Practice. These thorough and extensive Board of Medical Practice requirements will be in addition to what the athletic trainers are already subject to under current Minnesota state law. Athletic trainers are often confused with personal trainers. Therefore, I'd like to start with a brief overview of our educational requirements. Athletic trainers work with every conceivable sport and physically active injury. We are trained and certified to treat musculoskeletal injuries, those injuries that deal with bones, muscles, joints, ligaments, and tendons. We may be the first healthcare practitioner to attend your son or daughter during a hockey game, but we are just as likely to help be part of the healthcare team working with an overextended elbow after shoveling snow on the weekend. The education of the athletic trainer practitioner is much like the education of every other healthcare professional. Eligibility to sit for the board of certification examination and become nationally certified athletic trainer requires a bachelor's degree in athletic training and graduation from an accredited athletic training program. In fact, over 70% of athletic trainers hold advanced degrees of master's or higher. Universities such as University of Minnesota Duluth, University of Minnesota Mankato, Gustavus Adolphus College, Winona State, Bethel, St. Cloud State, and Moore, University of Minnesota Moorhead offer four-year bachelor's degree programs in athletic training. All athletic training education programs obtain accreditation by meeting standards of the Commission on Accreditation of Athletic Training, CATE. CATE is an independent accreditation agency supported and co-sponsored by the National Athletic Trainers Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine. Athletic training proficiency is taught and assessed in a formal classroom and laboratory setting and includes instruction in the following general subject matter: risk management and injury prevention, pathology of injuries and illness, orthopedic clinical examination and diagnosis, medical conditions and disabilities, acute care of injuries and illness, therapeutic modalities, conditioning and rehabilitative exercises, pharmacology, psychosocial intervention and referral, nutritional aspects of injury and illness, healthcare administration, professional development and responsibility. Once an athletic training student has graduated, they're eligible to sit for the Board of Certification exam. Successful passage is evidence of the ability to provide high quality of standard of care for the public. In addition, the credibility of the practitioner is guaranteed through the BOC Standards Practice Act and disciplinary process and required requirements for continued education. Those requirements state that an athletic trainer must have 75 hours of continued education every 3 years. The BOC recognizes six domains of athletic trainer skill set: prevention, clinical intervention and diagnosis, immediate care, treatment, rehabilitation and reconditioning, organization and administration, and professional responsibility. Finally, unlike other allied healthcare professionals, athletic trainers may practice only under the direction of a written signed protocol, physician protocol form. This means that our work is under the constant direction and supervision of a licensed physician 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Protocols are renewed regularly and must be maintained in order for an athletic trainer to continue practicing. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your time this evening and hearing the legislation. We are very proud of our profession and believe that we serve a valuable role in the healthcare industry. Just as importantly, athletic trainers feel we add an important component to the overall healthcare team. Whether we are seeing patients in the field or the clinical setting, athletic trainers collaborate and work in all healthcare professions to ensure patients get the level of care they expect and deserve.
Thank you. Members, before we move ahead, I should have done this earlier. I want to remind everyone of the ground rules, because these bills can be very contentious. And the proponents and opponents each will get 15 minutes, so you guys got about 5 left. And then after that, the members can ask questions after the presentation, so we'll save your questions, and we'll bring both opponent and proponent to the table, and you can address your questions to whoever you want to address it to. So you guys got 5 more minutes. I believe Mr. Dr. Dave Bornson is next. Welcome to the committee. You state your name for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Sorson. I'm a family physician. I practice in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I have been involved with athletic trainers since 1993, when I worked with them in developing their current legislation. I'm very active in the sports medicine community. I'm a family physician, but I have a certificate of added qualification in sports medicine and work with athletes at the high school level, the professional level, and I've worked with the U.S. ski team, traveling internationally and working with international competitors. So I work very closely with athletic trainers in multiple venues and have become very comfortable working with them. I was involved with the recent Council of Health Boards review as a member of the Board of Medical Practice, where I work as a medical coordinator as well. So I'm very familiar with the current legislation and the changes that were made in response to the council when they did this review. I cover local high schools. I work with the St. Paul Saints as well, and I have a wide experience, and I have found the athletic trainers to be a valuable asset in dealing with this integration of the injured athletes in on the field, as well as working with them in my office, where they deal with patients and help me in the rehabilitation of my patients with athletic injuries. I can tell you from my perspective, I'm speaking as an individual because I'm very active with both the MMA and the MAFP, that the changing of the name from patients to athletes really is just something that is changing with what they do. The person they're seeing at the time of injury is a patient. They are athletes as well, but to be consistent across the healthcare delivery system, they are patients. I think that's an important thing to realize. The athletic trainer's protocols are very precise and require physician supervision, and in fact, physicians have been disciplined for not appropriately supervising athletic trainers. So this is something that really is controlled very strictly within the Board of Medical Practice and within the community at large. So I do not feel that there is a risk to the people of having athletic trainers who are practicing out there without direct supervision of physicians. I have had no problems with athletic trainers accessing me with a need when athletes and their patients are injured and not appropriately responding to treatment. They have been very willing to call. They have access to me on a 24-hour day basis, and we have not had problems with them treating beyond their comfort zone and not getting them to appropriate medical care beyond the athletic training site. So I speak in favor of this. I do not see it as a change in scope of practice. I see it as a clarification of what they do, which is treating patients. And I actually see the changes that came from the Council of Health Board as being important to help protect the citizens, as Rob Leach has said, with tightening up the protocols for new grads and things like that. So I think that it actually helps protect the citizens in that way. I will be available for questions afterwards if there are any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Representative Thiessen, I guess, just conclude the proponent. The opponent may come to the table and then state your name for the record and who you represent. And you have 15 minutes.
Chairman Collins, committee members, I'm Kathy Brennan, and I represent the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. I believe that there are two reasons to oppose this bill, and I speak from the standpoint of protecting the public from potential harm. Changing the wording in the athletic trainer's regulatory statutes could result in possible misinterpretation of the knowledge, skills, and abilities of athletic trainers to our public. The proposed change would define patients very differently than other organizations, professions, and how the general public defines patients. Despite not changing the actual definition, by removing the word athlete and substituting the word patient, the implication is that treatment could be provided to any person for any injury, illness, or disease across the lifespan. This broad language implies that therapeutic interventions could be provided to the general public, not just individuals with athletic injuries. Despite what the Athletic Trainers Association has stated tonight, it does appear to be an attempt to broaden the potential scope of practice by manipulating the words in the statute. We question whether the current academic and experiential preparation of athletic trainers justifies expanding their scope of practice. Current pass-fail rates with the National Athletic Training Association Board of Certification in their March 2007 report of the 2006 certification results identifies that 62.5% of all athletic trainer candidates sitting for the certification test failed. 70% of those retaking the test failed. These very low passing statistics suggest the possibility that the current standards and competencies may lack breadth, depth, and uniformity and are resulting in variations in athletic or educational content among the training programs, as well as inconsistent student outcomes. Attached to this report is a table comparing the credit hours and the course descriptions of the 7 athletic training programs in Minnesota. This table was compiled using websites with public access. The table shows significant variation in credit hours in specific course content. If the current standards and competencies yield only a 37.5% pass rate, we have even greater concern that the potential broadening of the scope of practice will not be supported in the athletic trainer educational competencies. We acknowledge that the bill does not propose to change the definition of athletic injury, only the label attached to the definition. That definition in the proposed bill states, injury means injury sustained by a person as a result of the person's participation in exercises, sports, games, or recreation requiring physical strength, agility, flexibility, range of motion, speed, or stamina. However, what seems to have changed is the definition of the word exercise. As an example, a representative of the Minnesota Athletic Trainer Association, when we met with them as a group, was asked why auto insurance was paying for what currently is statutorily defined as an athletic injury. Her response was that it was within their scope because, for example, treating a truck driver who sustained an ankle fracture while getting out of his truck cab was injured during the exercise of getting out of his truck. and an ankle, fractured ankle, is a fractured ankle. We do not believe that the intent of the word exercise should encompass every movement that a person could potentially make. Athletic trainers, we also do not believe that all ankle fractures are treated the same. Patient factors such as age and comorbidities such as osteoporosis could have a significant impact on the plan of care. Athletic trainers' educational background and clinical exposure prepares them for a very specific population of athletes, well-conditioned, generally healthy individuals. Athletic trainer education does not focus on competencies to identify or provide rehabilitation services to individuals across the lifespan, especially those who have underlying health conditions, medical pathologies, or contributing factors, such as a child with cerebral palsy who fractures an elbow, an adult with multiple sclerosis who sustains a rotator cuff injury, or an elderly person with rheumatoid arthritis and dementia that has a wrist fracture. We believe that changing the statutory language will not reduce confusion, but rather it will increase confusion among the public. Representatives of the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association state the reason they are dropping the word athlete and athletic from their statutes is because it is confusing to the public, and they want to be aligned with other health care providers. It is our opinion that dropping these modifiers will only increase confusion with the public. We question why a profession that calls itself athletic trainers would want to remove all statutory reference to athletics. Why would the athletic trainer, who functions as an integral member of the athletic healthcare team in secondary schools, colleges, universities, sports medicine clinics, professional sports programs, and other athletic care settings, want to eliminate the very words that define their unique practice? The occupational therapy community is committed to ensuring that health care rendered to the public is provided by qualified health care professionals who can provide services safely and effectively. The Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association opposes the proposed language changes as it would cause more confusion to the public without ensuring the safety of people with injuries who are in vulnerable positions. The language is potentially too broad to assure competence with the current educational training of an athletic trainer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brennan. Can we have Mr. Doyle or Dr. Thornton to also be at the table with Ms. Brennan? Ms. Brennan, I would like you to stay at the table as well. And members, are there any questions that members have for either Mr. Doyle or Ms. Brennan?
I'll go ahead. Give me a second.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the testifiers. And I have a couple of questions that I guess I'd like both Ms. Brennan and Mr. Doyle to respond to, if you wouldn't mind. And I'm going to ask about each of your corresponding professions, if that's okay. The first question I have is about direct access and if patients or people have direct access to the care that you provide.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, athletic trainers, some of direct access that takes place, athletic trainers have a physician's protocol that is signed by a supervising physician to oversee our care. In that protocol, we do have a window that's used in a traditional setting. A traditional setting would be in a high school collegiate setting where a person that's injured comes in and sees us. Do we have a direct access through a clinical role model? No. There's the direct access that occurs would be involved in a traditional secondary school setting, collegiate setting.
Ms. Brennan?
Yes, we do have direct access, and that our licensure bill does not require a physician order. However, because of reimbursement issues, almost every payer does require a physician order. So,
I have a follow-up for Mr. Doyle. This bill doesn't change that direct access, does it?
Correct. There's no change at that. No change involving the direct access or our physician protocol system.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question, if I might. For Mr. Doyle, you talk about direct supervision, or supervision by a supervising physician. Does the physician need to be on site, or is there in the agreement that you have, the supervising agreement, some description of how the athletic trainer is supervised by the supervising physician?
Representative Murphy, there is not direct supervision. It does not need to be on site. We need to be able to have contact with the physician for questions or such. But in the protocol, it outlines what skill sets we can use. The skill sets are there as the maximum, and the physician has the complete control to limit the scope of practice that the athletic trainer can do by some part by limiting the number of days they can see somebody, and such as in the secondary school setting, and also limiting what they feel comfortable with the athletic trainer practicing. I mean, what they do. So, it's in the written protocol of how the supervision is overseen.
Ava. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure people know I have a son who's an athletic trainer, and he just graduated from a very rigorous program in California, and I was been very impressed with what he knows. I don't try to get into a contest anymore. My boys are 29 years ago, so I don't even try. But I was actually very impressed with his training and the credential he came out with. And the test, it seems like the bad test if that many are failing a test, but it's very rigorous, and I know it's just a bare test. I don't know if that's the reason. You wonder about the test, if they designed a test to be so, but I know that they were happy to pass it, but they what he's learned is very good, and I asked the trainers when they came in my office, excuse me, the athletic trainers when they came in my office. He chides me for that because he's an athletic trainer, ATC, and I meant well when I said that, excuse me to him. But anyway, when I asked the athletic trainers when they came to my office to talk about the bottom of the profession, because I've done a lot of licensure work, and you don't really worry about the top of the profession. I expect every new graduate is right close to the top with the newest knowledge, and they assured me that the bell curve of providers is actually relatively tight, and there's not a lot of stragglers and just ones that are barely functioning, and that was reassuring to me because I know you want a license and credential for the middle of the pack, and at the top you can't keep up with them, and it can't, all of the profession can't have the freedoms at the top of the credentialing group, but you want to make sure at least that the bulk of the population of the licensed group or credentialed group is such. And I was very comfortable with this, and I've been reading this and talking to three people on both sides of this. This to me seems very technical in terms of what the change is. And until you change the definition of an injury, whatever you call what it is you're doing, I don't think you've made any big dent. And I was talking to one of the lobbyists there, and I said, is this really what you're going to do, which is basically nothing? And so I understand the concern. But it seems to me, as I listen to the testimony, that you're even under more scrutiny and under more limitations than a physical therapist would be on their limitations at times.
Hold on. If you have your cell phone on, please turn off. We're getting a lot of static. So, sorry. Go ahead.
Maybe it's me giving you static, Mr. Chair. Anyway, so it seems like there's a very, very tight boundary that the referring physician would have under this. Can you just want to comment about that? And I think you already mentioned that you have to do a certain amount of things, but maybe just compare your limitations to a physical therapist, which I think it gets a little blank note saying evaluate and treat for a period of time and do whatever. Is that a good question? Mr. Doyle?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards. Yes, again, the scope of practice that we currently have is not being broadened. The definition of what an athlete is not being changed. I mean, it still continues to read the definition of an athlete, whether it's an athlete or a patient, it did not change. It means a person participating in exercise, sport, game, or recreation requiring physical strength, agility, flexibility, range of motion, speed, and stamina. Is that a broad scope? You know, is that encompassing a lot? I would say that's what follows our educational requirements. Another part is, like you said, you worry about the bottom 10%. When you have a high failure rate at the Board of Certification, that shows that you're doing everything you can to weed out the bottom 10%, the part that we worry about doing harm to the public. And again, we have a much more restrictive practice because we have to follow under a physician's protocol at times because we work with side by side with the physicians. Athletic trainers work as part of a healthcare team. We're allied healthcare professionals. We are not trying to work independently. We are not trying to, be a unique provider. We're trying to continue to work with the healthcare providers to provide a high quality of care, be it with a physician, be it with a physical therapist, occupational therapist, chiropractor. So the scope of practice and the restrictions versus physical therapists per your request, like you said, physical therapists are given much more freedom in that, and that I'm not testifying towards their profession, but the scope and they do not define their patients in a limited statute like we do. We're actually given a definition, which is a unique situation in those professions.
So follow up, Representative Ava?
Well, just a comment, and I appreciate the concerns of the OTs on this, and I think that I've done more licensure work than I care to remember on these things, and there's always a conflict. It's nice the ophthalmologists and the optometrists were happy this morning. Earlier today, that was a pretty bad fight a few years ago. But I think from reading the words, I don't think the OTs have any concern that this is anything more than a technical change. That's my view, and I think we should pass the bill.
We have two more members. We'll go with Representative Murphy and then Representative Bunn. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just one final question, and this is about reimbursement or payment. And I'm wondering if you could just describe for me how it is that you are paid. I don't know if you're reimbursed per athlete or if you're salaried. Not you particularly, I don't want to invade your privacy, but if you could just generally talk about that a little bit, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, athletic trainer, I am compensated as an individual athletic trainer, is what you're looking for. I'm compensated on a salary basis. I mean, some athletic trainers are compensated on an hourly basis. We do not have direct billing access. We cannot go out and bill third-party reimbursers at this time. Nowhere in this bill is there any language to indicate that such a measure could be taken, and nowhere are we trying to include language to say that third-party reimbursement has to be set. We always work as part of a healthcare team. We work hand-in-hand with other healthcare professionals to deliver care, and we're working in a clinical setting. That's how the revenue would be generated.
And just one follow-up to that, Mr. Doyle. Would it require a statutory change for third-party reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I do. I mean, I worked in healthcare for 17 years trying to get any third-party reimbursement involved, trying to get Blue Cross Blue Shield or such to say that, you know, they're going to jump on board. is a phenomenal task in there. It's a free enterprise system, but there's no mechanism to force anything to do it. It would have to be something that would be a mutual agreement. And like I said, it's not in our legislation.
Representative Murphy, we would need a mandate to do that. Yeah. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair. I actually have questions for all three of you, but let me start with Dr. Thorson, since you haven't gotten to speak much yet. Dr. Thorson, in your practice, is the athletic trainer actually an integrated part of your practice, your clinical setting, or is it something you forcing, they're part-time, or you outsource to, or how does that work?
The answer to your question is yes in all those areas. Okay. We've done it in various ways. I work on the sidelines of the local high school, supervising athletic trainers there. I'm sometimes at the high school at the sidelines. I'm sometimes in my office where I'm getting called by the trainer. I'm at home getting called by the chairman. They're covering athletic events. Mm-hmm. I've worked with the athletic trainer for the St. Paul Saints at the at Midway Stadium, working there. Mm-hmm. I've had athletic trainers work with me in my sports medicine clinics at my outpatient clinic, working side by side and helping teach exercises and things like that. So I've worked at all those levels with athletic trainers.
Here, Dr. Thorsen, you indicated you're a family practice doctor. Do you only have a sports medicine clinic, or do you offer general practice?
I practice a full range of family practice, including delivering baby stuff.
Yeah, okay. And okay, so then my next question to you is, when you use an athletic trainer outside the context of when you're on the sports field and actually going to the professional teams, when in your practice, your family practice setting, would you refer to, for example, the wrist fracture or badly sprained ankle, something, to an athletic trainer versus a OT versus a PT?
Mr. Thorsen.
When they're working with me in my clinic, they're helping me do patient education and teaching exercises. When patients are referred for rehabilitation, they're referred to a physical therapist, not an athletic trainer. Depending on the injury, they could be referred to an occupational therapist as well. There are limitations in what occupational therapists do and physical therapists do, so it depends on the injury and the type of treatment we're looking for. I hope that's fair to the occupational therapist.
One more. Go ahead, Representative.
I have a question for the others too.
Go ahead.
Dr. Thorsen, when you said they're doing teaching patient exercises, like for example, people have lower back pain often go through exercise, are taught exercises to maintain maintain themselves in better shape and prevent injury. Is it the case that those individuals receiving the exercise training are necessarily having received it as a function of injury related to any athletic or exercise activity, or could they have just received it from life in general or doing something in their home?
I think that we try and encourage all our patients to be active and athletes, and so the answer to your question is somewhat difficult. I think the person who is shoveling snow and gets low back pain is involved in an athletic mm-hmm. attempt, for those of us who have shoveled snow recently. And in that respect, I will use them, but I do not refer to them for prolonged rehabilitation. They're in my clinic to help me get the patient started on an exercise routine while they're transitioned to physical therapy. So it gives me the ability to get somebody started on exercises safely in the process of getting them into the physical therapist. So they're not doing continual care in my office setting. They're simply used as a help to get people started. On the athletic field, they're obviously dealing with athletes there, but in my perspective, the term athletic injury is fairly broad, because the housewife who sprains her ankle and is trying to take care of three children under the age of five has to be more athletic sometimes than the football player who sprains their ankle, and so getting them back to function quickly is important from a physical therapy perspective as well as from an athletic trainer perspective.
Mm-hmm. So somebody, you got more questions?
Yes, I have a question. And for Mr. Doyle, then, could you comment on what Ms. Brennan, her remarks in two areas? One, what she had to say about the training, although you did just allude to it a minute ago in terms of the percentage that passed the first exam, et cetera, whether or not the training that you received is appropriate to more broadly treat people with injuries in general. I mean, Dr. Thorsen just mentioned that, the housewife who hurt herself, while children are working on the home. So it does sound like we're leaning towards a broad interpretation, a non-necessary athlete interpretation of exercise injury. So comment on the training issue, then comment on her remark regarding her view that you're really trained to treat well-conditioned, healthy people, if not the general population.
Mr. Doyle. Brennan. You addressing to Mr. Doyle?
No,
Mr. Doyle.
Right. No, yeah. Mr. Chairman and Representative. I'm just writing at the same time, so I try to address the question. I would the training in regards to more broadly, again, some of it, like we discussed, that some of it is, I think, a failure rate is a good thing. If you have 100% pass rate on your test, I don't think your test is doing its job in helping to weed out the people. Some of it, as we discussed before, one of the things that was mentioned is that we don't have comorbidity type issues. I mean, pathology of injuries and illness. We have the Athletic Training Education Committee 4th edition report. I mean, in there it goes over, in order to demonstrate knowledge of the practice of athletic training, to think critically about practice involved athletic training, includes the ability to integrate knowledge, skills, and behaviors, assume professional responsibility, the use of learning objectives to outcomes of pathology and injury illness to ensure that the athlete, to ensure the student is able to describe the essential components of typical human cells, including structure and function, explain growth, failure, adaption, explain normal, abnormal circulation and physiology of fluid hemostasis, identify normal and acute chronic psychological, psychosocial and pathological responses, including body trauma, hypoxia, microbiology. I mean, it's all laid out quite extensively, and I'll be more than happy to give you this this book to review of the educational competencies in regards to that. Also, as long as athletic training has been a profession, there's been one of the criteria for the educational process is medical conditions and disability. And again, it reviews the practice of athletic training and things that we need to go through for there. Describing knowledge and refer to common injuries, physical disability, disease affecting people who engage in physical activity throughout their life. Examples, arthritis, diabetes. These are things we do not treat. These are things that we need to be able to identify and make appropriate referrals on for care. We do not treat diabetic patients, do not treat diabetic athletes, but I work with diabetic athletes every day. It's my responsibility as an athletic trainer to make sure that if I identify this as a concern, that I make an appropriate referral to a family practice physician, and then make sure I consult with that family practice physician so that way we can do a proper monitoring technique of the diabetes so it doesn't become a problem. Juvenile diabetes is a significant increase in it, and if you want to talk, it's one of the biggest costs to our healthcare system. So, I mean, there are continuations of the evaluation process and recognition of injuries. I would highly dispute the claims made that we do not have the educational. It's outlined in there that these are things that need to be done. The students go through. They need to be able to demonstrate that they have these skills that they can identify and have an understanding of what they are looking for before they can get checked off on it. They need to go through a competencies list. They need to make sure that they're checking off their skills as they go forward. If they have not shown competencies in a specific skill, they're not allowed to sit for the national exam. They need to go through to the checks and balance system to make sure that they are educated.
Do you have any more? That's something.
Yes,
go ahead.
Again, I want to go back just then to Ms. Brennan then and ask her to respond to the answers we've heard since we haven't, before we continue.
I still would say that I would be concerned about the broadness of the definition, the expansion of the housewife, that that's an athletic activity. I'm concerned. I don't think that's an athletic activity. I would be concerned, again, treating the groups of patients that do have comorbidities, recognizing when you do need to refer. If you don't know what you don't know how to move on from there. However, that being said, there certainly is a wonderful place for athletic training. I believe that. But when we start removing athletics from the definition of what is your prize, that's your piece of the pie. And you're making it, you're diminishing it, in my mind, by removing the very thing that sets you apart from the rest of us, and that is the athletic training. My concern about the comments about the certification exam, when you do not even pass halfway, if you don't even have 50% of your students passing your competency test, and yet they've been checked off on all the competencies in order to sit for the exam, that's a concern I have. The validity rate and the reliability rate I looked up on the test, and it says it's high. So if the reliability of the test is high and less than 50% of the athletic training students can match it, then I have to say, what's wrong with the competencies? Why aren't they reflecting them what it is that you're trying to test. Again, just my feelings on it. But I am concerned about the broadness of the change in language. I'm not sure that we are hearing that then those competencies are going to match the broad definition of illness, injury that we're hearing.
Go ahead, Representative Blaney, last question.
Thank you, Chair. A quick follow-up to that. In terms of the statistics on the failure rates for sitting for native exams, do you know the same numbers for the OTs or PTs and or PTs?
The passing rate average last year for occupational therapy was 88%. I think the Physical Therapy Association is somewhere near 85% for the state, and I'm not sure on the national basis. And they are accurate in that you don't want 100% because then probably your test is not testing what you want. But 37.5%? No.
The door, you have anything to add or no?
Mr. Chair, it's a stat I have not heard before, so I can't comment on something that I can.
That's fine.
Okay.
I do have a question. Representative Finch, I like to think of him as a simple farm boy. I like to think of myself a simple guy from the city here. Explain to me, currently, you, under current law, for example, I'm not an athlete. I go down the street, I sprain my ankle. I come in, my doctor refers me to you. Can you treat me with that sprained ankle, even though I'm not an athlete under current law?
Under current law, I mean, you went to a physician, the physician asked you, the purpose for referring it to an athletic trainer would be kind of questionable. I don't know why they would specifically do that. They may refer you to physical therapy or such, where an athletic trainer may assist in
this. But my question is, can you treat me?
Can I treat you now? I mean, if it's, again, it has to be on the, it goes back to the physician, what they're directing the person to do and their interpretation of what the injury took to happen. So, I mean, it's somewhat of I don't have a specific answer. For that, you know, if it's a musculoskeletal injury that happened during, if it's an injury that happens during, you know, the definition of injury sustained by a person as a result of a person participating in exercise, sport, game, recreation, requiring physical strength, agility, flexibility, range of motion, speed, and stamina, you know, the answer would be yes. I mean, if you're walking down the street, taking in a physical activity, and spraining your ankle, technically you are an athlete, and that's an athletic injury.
All right. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. I guess at first blush, when I looked this over, I thought, oh, this is not that big of a deal. I had some questions. The questions I had to do with the change of language. And I guess I still keep coming back to that. I guess if I've learned anything serving on this committee is that scope of practice is deeply important to everybody. The term patient, in my mind, does open up the door. To me, the athletic, the current terminology defines exactly what you do and what you're trained to do. And the proposed language does open the door. And I guess I've heard from a lot of people this week, and I'm going to ask a question of one of them, I think, in a moment. But before I do that, I do want to address this issue with the testing and accreditation that was just mentioned. If we change the language as suggested to patients and injuries and open that door, I guess I would be, I'm wondering if the competencies that are currently being tested for then are still, and even though they're maybe not being successfully reached by a large percent, which we've heard, are they still relevant when you've opened the door to a broader range of patients? The competencies are really geared toward athletes and athletics, and now we're saying patient, and as I've heard, it may open the door for more doctors to refer to more athletic trainers as opposed to PTs or OTs. And if so, are the competencies that the athletic trainer is being tested for still going to be relevant, or should maybe those need to be looked at as well? That's my first question, and then I do want to address another issue.
afterwards.
Mr. Chair, can I Representative Keith respond? I think we can use your question as kind of answering a lot of these questions. You said if you sprain your ankle, can you be treated now? And I think the key answer to this question is if you can be treated now, you're going to be able to be treated later after this passes. And if you can't be treated now, you're not going to be able to be treated later. The competencies, I mean, the scope of the practice is not changing. The definition is not changing. So the same kind of competencies you've had before would be the same kind of competencies that would be had after the fact. And I just can't see how, you know, there was a comment made that now, by making this change, we're going to be able to treat any person for any injury across the population. That's just not true. I mean, that's not what the language says. And with all due respect, it's simply not the case. So my answer to that question would be, I think this whole issue of the certification and the testing is a red herring. And if they want to deal with that issue and they think that's a problem, they ought to come in with a bill that deals with that issue. The bottom line is, if you read the language, they can do today what they can do today, they'll be able to do tomorrow. What they can't do today, they won't be able to do tomorrow.
And some other people may want to address that, but then I will follow up, because that question came to me at the table. That was not a concern when I walked in the room. That just came to me as I was listening to that discussion. I still get back to the question of why we're changing a definition that is so completely accurate for an athletic trainer to teach athletes. Why we want to change the language? To me, it confuses things rather than open than confuses them. Let's just leave it at that. I want to follow up with my second piece, which is I have worked in the area of special ed, and I did work with young children. And we referred often to OTs and PTs. And as some of you know, and this is, I guess, the question, we have not heard from PTs, and the emails and the letters I've been getting have all been from PTs, not OTs. So I'm surprised they're not at the table, and I guess I would ask for them to comment. But one of the emails, or one of the pieces, was about the scope of practice being opened up to deal with children with disabilities, and it's a several-year-old article. But this, in addition to an email I got from a constituent athletic trainer who said, vote for this, it will open up my scope of practice, are where the red lights came on for me, where I started saying, oh, okay, I didn't think this was a scope of practice bill. And now, as I'm hearing it, I am getting concerned, and again, I would appreciate, one, hearing from the physical therapist, because that's all that I've heard from, and they're not at the table, so I guess I would appreciate hearing from them. And two, if someone could one more time, I know you addressed it early on, but if you could address one more time why you feel the need to diffuse your treatment by just calling the patients rather than keeping it pinpointed on athletes.
Just to answer the first question about the PTs, they've informed me that they will not be testifying tonight unless they change their mind, but that's that. And Mr. Doyle, go ahead and answer the second piece of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, with the education, part of it is the education, the healthcare field continuously morphs and continuously moves forward. Practices that were done 20 years ago are not the practices we do today. Everything continues to move forward. Athletic trainers have been in the, like I said, we have six domains of practice, but in the domain of rehab, in the current education model, we do not use the term athlete. We do when we talk about the football player, but when we talk about when we treat patients, we treat people, and we treat injuries. We don't treat athletic injuries. That's not what's taught in the programs anymore. Back previously, when the original program started, there were two ways to become a certified athletic trainer, and that was through a curriculum type program, which had the educational guidelines set up, and then also through an internship route. That route, the profession decided was not an appropriate to continue to monitor the educational process, and so the internship route was done away with. The internship was done away with in the 90s, and it took a little bit of time to morph out. But again, in the educational process, they do not use the term athlete. They do not use the term athletic injuries. We treat injuries and patients. You have another question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just follow up on that. Then is there any reason why leaving the bill in its current language using the term athlete and athletic injury, that in your practice you can't call them patients?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dorf.
Representative Norton. Part of it is, okay, I started to answer the question in my head before I think you finished, but with your actual question. But part of it is somewhat a confusion. Is a 42-year-old that jogs on a regular basis and such, is that person an athlete? A lot of people don't consider themselves athletic. When you say the term athlete to somebody, name me an athlete, no, very few people are going to say my neighbor Dave or me. They're going to say, you know, they're going to say Kevin Garnett. They're going to say a major sporting figure. People don't interpret at themselves as being an athlete, especially once you're past a certain age. I mean, there's very, very few people that consider that. And that's part of the, that's where we feel the confusion comes in, is because you can't do that because you're not an athlete. And then, but according to the definition of what an athlete is, that they are an athlete. You know, like Representative Peterson said, we can't do tomorrow, this bill doesn't change what we can provide in services. It's still the same definition.
We're getting close to voting too, but I see that a gentleman wants to testify. State your name for the record and who are you with.
My name is Dan Wolf and I represent the physical therapist. And I believe there's a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll just reiterate. I have received many pieces of communication in the last week or two from physical therapists very concerned with this impinging on their scope of practice. One article, as I mentioned, was with regard to children with special needs, but I think the other emails have been more broadly interpreted. I guess since I heard from so many physical therapists, I was surprised and I saw some in the room that I wasn't hearing from someone tonight, and I just wondered if you would give your input, please.
Mr. Wolfman, go ahead.
Sure. I guess our opinion mirrors that of the occupational therapist, and we didn't want to be redundant. We believe this is truly a scope of practice issue, and I think the answers that we've heard tonight in trying to define who's an athlete and who isn't, if people have been treating housewives with both back pain, as Dr. Thorson mentioned, and with an elbow pain from shoveling, if people have been treating those as athletes, I don't believe that redefining what you're already doing beyond the scope of your practice is a reason to change things. We do have a meeting set up next Wednesday to meet with the athletic trainers to discuss this, and this will be the first time we've had a chance to talk to them since last August.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Representative Bunn, did you have one final one?
Just a final clarifying point, if you would, Mr. Chair. The difference in the training, is it between these three things in terms of, they all have the undergraduate, but what are the years of graduate training that each of the three professions have?
Well, so Mr. Wolfman will get on the table.
Physical therapy is currently an under, an entrance level doctorate degree.
Mr. Doyle?
Athletic training is currently a 4-year bachelor's degree, and 70% of athletic trainers have advanced degrees in the profession.
Ms. Brennan?
Our entry level is master's level.
Okay. Good. Okay, I renew my motion with recommend to pass as amended to Health Human Service Policy. So all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Bill adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Someone called division?
Yes.
Okay. There's a division. See the ears. Raise your hand for those who are in favor of the bill. Three. Okay. Those opposed? Okay. I guess the chair's ears are not as good as he thought. So the bill does not pass on a tie vote. Thank you, Representative Keaton.
My ears are bad.
Thank you. Representative Walker, go ahead. I guess I will move House File 1724, and I believe we have, we're going to do the all, delete all amendments first, and then after that we have several amendments to the delete all. So, I also move the AO8-1139 amendment.
Yep.
Can you then, why don't you go ahead and...
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. Hopefully we're going soon. Yes, here we go. Trying to get folks up here. I'm going to have Mr. Campbell explain the delete all, and then I'll do the other one.
Okay, for the record, Dan Campbell, representing the Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Mr. Chair, we have a delete all amendment, and I'll start with that. Just get with it.
We just moved that so it's in there already. Just address to the delete all amendment.
Just this one. So basically, we have the delete all amendment that updates from last year. There was a licensure bill for a naturopath. This actually changes it to a registration bill. We have worked with the medical board, the state. We've worked with a bunch of the different parties to try to come to a bill that basically takes. We have 26 practitioners in the state that have a post 4-year graduate program with a 4-year medical degree and elevate central status where they're allowed to perform many of the functions that they have tested to. And they have passed the United States Board of Education standards and requirements, aka the study manual, I guess, over there. And what else do you want to go over? I think that's about it.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. I just forgot. I moved the amendment, but we didn't technically vote on it. So this amendment is for the in the shape that the author wants. So all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the most important piece of this amendment is actually listening to the concerns that committee members, especially you, Mr. Chair, had, and not wanting to go as far as licensure at this time. However, we wanted still to make sure that there was a distinction and making sure that we acknowledged and recognized the medical background that these 26 individuals have and wanting to make sure of that. And then, Mr. Chair, I'd like to keep it brief because I know you have a lot, still a long night in front of you with that great dental hygienist issue.
Representative Walker, why don't I move? We do the amendments, and then we could discuss some of the amendments. Members, I have the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to explain that amendment?
I could do it. I could do it.
Okay.
I'll try, and then if I miss anything, I got some friends in the audience who will help with the technical stuff. Essentially, we are taking out the expansion of the scope from this provision. We taking away the ability to prescribe a lot of the medications that were asked, and also the childbirth piece of it. We're also taking that out. Changing from diagnosed into assessment. I believe right now docs could diagnose, but Kairos, Representative Abraham, am I correct, only assessment instead of diagnose the patient. Oh, you diagnose as well. So we're not going as far as diagnosing, but giving them the ability to do assessment. So essentially that's the amendment on this, and I have checked with the proponent of the bill and Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's important to note this is actually an amendment working with the MMA and trying to resolve some of their issues and come to a compromise. While there are individuals that are trained in naturopathic medicine that are doing midwifery work, wanting to respect the chair and take the baby steps necessary to move this bill along out of committee today.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Okay, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the A1 has been adopted. I believe, Representative Avery, you have an amendment as well.
If you want to do it now, I think I chatted with the author. I guess they'd be working off the 1139, page 17. You've been following up on your work, Mr. Chair. Section 4, which is line 17.13 to... it's online. It wrote those functional languages on line 17.24. It just struck the word naturopathy from the Alternative and Complementary Act. I was trying to find out if homeopathy was licensed under the Board of Medical Practice, but this is it's technical, but it's very important to the people who practice, who are going to be allowed to practice naturopathy anyway,
sure,
without being one of the licensed bunch. This list is a meaningless list of many things that are allowed under the Alternative and Complementary Act. Example, to strike a name from a list that doesn't have, that's not inclusive, isn't a real substantive change to start with, but it goes the way that I think is not respectful of those that are hoping to be allowed to continue on as the authors intend. So if I could move to delete section 4 on page 17 and 18, I would do that.
Okay, Representative Abler moves to delete section 4. The whole section, I believe.
It's just one line, but not the whole section would go out.
Okay. Representative Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just reinstating the language that was stricken and the amendment that's before us. We're okay with that. Members, just to know that hopefully this does resolve some of the issues that individuals that are practicing naturopathic medicine in different forms that have not had more of the advanced training that these 26 individual physicians have does settle some of the turf issues that are that have been before us in past years.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Avery.
This is a bigger point, and I this is still a bill in progress. I hope that the opponents as well as the proponents, I commend the proponents for doing all these steps to move the bill along. I hope the opponents notice that. There's two different kinds of opponents, the medical groups and then the lay naturopath group, but I hope they both recognize the efforts that these folks are making. These, I think it's 26 potential licensed registrants now, really have a good credential, and I think they'll benefit the health system in Minnesota. An issue that's remaining unopened is what titles they'll protect, and that's not, and it's my advice, if I could, to the testifiers, is that they kind of keep it at the overview level. Mm. They'll be having meetings and working out something, so I don't know that we want to do a lot of fighting about this tonight. We can, when they get a deal, we can just take off the gloves on your chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our great counsel, although we have her swamped with many different issues, Ms. Ace is going to help us, hopefully, if there is any possible way to be helped in the next few days. If anybody can find it, Ms. Ace will be able to do it.
First of all, yeah. This bill still has a long ways to go, so I think we could move on with small steps. But with Representative Abler's oral amendment is to delete Section 4. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I have one more amendment.
To Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have you move the A1 amendment or the... Why are they both A1?
We did that already.
I did that already.
Okay, you did. Oh, this is the second page. Okay.
The bill's in order. Representative Walker, do you have any additional testimony? If not, we're going to move on to the opponent of the bill.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, because this is still one of those things that, and I told my folks to be very short and brief because I know the type of schedule you have tonight. but wanting to make sure that it was on the record and making sure that members had all the information going forward to voting on this, that there is a distinction. You know, it's one of those things that has happened for years in the past as it relates to nurse practitioners, and it's one that will be revisited for years to come. It's one that you'll be taking up with dental hygienists in just a short time. But these individuals aren't just individuals that haven't gone to medical school. These are individuals that have taken a variety of courses. They're wanting to recognize them and register them tonight. And so, Mr. Chair, if you would just bear with us and just give them a couple brief minutes.
Yeah, you guys still have 5 minutes. So.
Thank
you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr.
State your name for the record.
Sure, my name is Leslie Walensky. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I am trained as a naturopathic doctor, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians. I have 4 years of an undergraduate education with an emphasis in pre-med, and 4 years of graduate-level residential naturopathic medical school, including 3 years of supervised clinical training. I have passed national board exams. I currently hold a license to practice naturopathic medicine in Washington State, where naturopathic doctors practice as primary care providers, and where it is mandated that naturopathic medicine is covered under all major health care plans. Although Minnesota does not currently regulate the practice of naturopathic medicine, I continue to maintain my Washington license through continuing education requirements as mandated by Washington state law, requiring 25 credit hours each year. My colleague, Helen Healy, the past president of our association, could not be here tonight because she is teaching herbal medicine in the Holistic Health Master's Program at the College of St. Catherine. I have a prepared statement I would like to read at this time, addressing some of the concerns we're talking about. On the issue of health freedom, all of the unlicensed CAM and natural health practitioners currently have a legal right to practice under Minnesota Statute 146A, and anyone who can afford to pay them for their services has the freedom to access them. These freedoms will not change due to the regulation of naturopathic medicine in Minnesota, because the proposed legislation does not repeal or annul that law. There will still be unlicensed CAM providers, and they will still be protected by Minnesota Statute 146A. Not regulating a group of qualified, highly educated, license-holding naturopathic doctors takes away patient choice. Institutions such as county community clinics that rely on the state's credentialing process that would want to have an ND on staff do not have the choice. Medical doctors who want to refer their patients on to a credentialed naturopathic doctor for further or alternative treatment are impeded. Those injured who would want to have comprehensive care from an integrated healthcare team that included a registered naturopathic doctor to perform therapeutic restorative injections or IV nutrition have no choice. The same goes for the elderly, the vulnerable, and many other groups. Minnesota raised the level of training and practice standards for acupuncturists. It is long overdue for the state to insist upon a higher level of training and practice standards for the naturopathic profession. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Walensky. Ma'am, did you have anything to add? State your name for the record and you may continue.
Yes, I'm Dr. Carolyn Torkelson, and I am a medical doctor at the University of Minnesota and the current medical director of the Women's Health Center at the University of Minnesota. I am here to support the registration of naturopathic physicians in Minnesota. You may ask me why. Well, I see a lot of patients with chronic medical conditions, and they really ask me every day for integrative medicine. They want information on diet, nutrition, herbs, botanicals, vitamins, and supplements. They want information on natural ways to heal and lifestyle changes. They want to know how they can enhance their care beyond the conventional medicine that they're already receiving from me. Many physicians, unfortunately, are not prepared to answer many of these questions. But naturopathic physicians who are graduates of an accredited 4-year school of naturopathy are highly trained to do this. Now, I make many referrals and work collaboratively with current naturopathic physicians, and I believe we need to utilize their skills to provide comprehensive care in both preventative medicine and the plethora of chronic disease that we have in Minnesota. We need to register these professionals so that they can work hand in hand with us in the medical community. And I need to know which, as a referring physician, which practitioners are safe to make referrals to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Horkinson. I guess this concludes the proponent of the bill. We do have opponents of the proposal. Why don't we go into that, and then after this, we'll do the questions for both groups. So, the opponents, Mr. Schmidt, and I guess Mr. Jerry Johnson is not coming, so... And Ms. Nancy Ohm? Go ahead, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I am president of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. I am a carpenter by trade. I say that only to make sure that people know that this is not part of a food fight, so you're not refereeing between a unlicensed naturopath, the proponents of this bill. Our organizations were formed about 12 years ago specifically in response to the actions against Helen Healy by the Board of Medical Practice and by the Attorney General's Office. In the intervening years since then, we have attempted to work with this organization many times on language to try to help them achieve what they want to achieve in terms of expanding their practices. Unfortunately, I believe through 5 iterations of this of their bill, we have never been shown the language until the last minute. Hardly a collaborative effort, and unfortunately, it's happened again this year. We have a delete all amendment that wasn't available until, I believe, sometime early this morning. I don't know how I can be asked in a collaborative manner. I don't know how I can be asked to get approval of my board and members to language that I haven't had the chance to look at in any depth. As I spoke last year in the informative issue, our organization has a general reticence towards licensure for these reasons. Licensing fences the practitioners in as much as it fences the people who can't apply for the license out, which means that there's a limit to their ability to innovate. The scope of practice is very clear about what you can and cannot do. The advantage, in my estimation, that natural health modalities offer and that Chapter 146 offers is that it allows people to add other modalities, other information as it comes about in order to bring greater information to the consuming public. My feeling about any licensure bill is that it restricts those things. And the very nature of licensing, while it claims to raise the bar, the license in and of itself can't do that. You can study for the technical aspects of that, but the honor that a practitioner has towards his client's trust, his client's time, his client's money, is what fosters that mutual respect that is necessary. And it just seems to me that this move towards licensure doesn't really, in fact, provide any advantage at all to consumers. In fact, it's limiting to them, because now they'll be going, well, I don't understand, what's the difference with this and that and everything else. There have been some progress made in this bill in terms of things that the practitioners have removed, but I would argue that the things that they've removed is reflective of that whole issue. They've taken them out. They're trained to do these things, but they can't do them because they're stepping on somebody else's scope of practice. And to repeat that same fallacy of moving towards something which is limited is limiting, which I think a licensing scope is, I don't think is advantageous to the consumer. So at this point, because we haven't had a chance to really study it,
We will oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Holmes. And then I believe there's another person that wants to testify on this as well. Go ahead, Ms. Holmes. State your name for the record.
My name is Nancy Holmes, and I'm a traditional naturopath, homeopath, and a registered nurse. I do not... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Powell.
Go ahead. You're fine. You're fine. You're doing fine.
I'm nervous.
Don't be.
Okay. Although I do not hold myself out as an RN, nor do I work in the medical field currently. I have a private practice of naturopathy and homeopathy. I'm the co-founder of the Minnesota Natural Health Coalition and the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project, although I am not representing either of those organizations tonight. Tonight I come to you as a citizen, a consumer, and a traditional naturopath. In 1998, the coalition came to the Minnesota legislature to create a legal environment in which the citizens of our state could have access to their natural health practitioners. I have included the medical statute for you under history in the handout. We had two parts to this legislation. The first part made it legal for licensed individuals to add natural therapies to their practice. This would include physicians, nurses, physician's assistants, psychologists, social workers, and the list of licensed individuals. The second half was to make it legal for citizens of Minnesota to access all of the unlicensed practitioners. That would include such people as homeopaths, naturopaths, herbalists, and the body workers, and that list of 22 plus that you have in front of you that they tried to cross out naturopathy on. And thank you, representatives, for Representative Abler, I guess you left, for cutting out Section 4. In the first of 15 hearings, the Health Committee and the Minnesota House of Representatives threw out Part 1, the part for licensed individuals. There were members of the committee that led a protest saying that it would not be right to have doctors using natural health. But they said not to worry, and that soon they would revisit this issue separately, and we tried to pin them down now as to how soon that would be. That was in 1998. We went through 15 hearings in the spring of 2000. This bill, 146A, passed overwhelmingly in the Minnesota legislature with one dissenting vote in the Senate. 146A allows the practitioners in this room, every single one of them, to practice natural therapies legally. There's an acupuncture licensing law and a midwifery licensing law that I have every confidence that these expert individuals that are standing to my left that can pass muster on those regulations. But I'm here to oppose this legislation, House File 1724, for the following reasons. I prepared this testimony, however, before I saw that the medical board removed all the things I'm talking about, the medications. I'm very glad that they cut that out because the practice of natural health is not about giving chemicals and medications. We want
Ms. Holmes,
our state.
Yeah, I'd like us to concentrate on just...
Yeah, so I have to go through now and cut that out because we just changed that. But we want these practitioners to exist. We have offered for 11 years to come to the table and discuss this. We have creative ideas of how they can go and practice the modalities that they want to practice over and above what's covered in 168. They will not come to the table. The Council of Boards, I put it in front of you, they said these people are not coming, do not go toward licensure or regulation until both sides have come to something. I didn't see this bill till 1 o'clock today. We've been trying to get this language for a week. So we ask that we don't move ahead tonight with a vote putting this forward because we want them to work. We want them to do what they want to do, but they shouldn't be doing it under regulation and licensure, and it doesn't have to happen that way. There are other creative ways. Please have them come to the table, and we can share that with them. Thank you.
Okay. We have one additional testifier, I believe, for the opponent. You have about 5 or 6 more minutes before we move on to questioning. Go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Leo Cashman, and Chair Powell. I'm also a consumer and been active for about 10 years on the health freedom issue and one of the people who worked hard to pass 146A. That was finally passed in year 2000. And thank you, some of you at least, who were part of the health committee who helped us move forward on health freedom. And I think your hearts are still in that same place. And I very much appreciate Representative Abler and Representative Walker in that. I think we realized when we passed the bill in year 2000 that it was a great step forward for our licensed practitioners, but that it did not cover some of the scope of practice that our friends, the naturopathic physicians, naturopathic medical doctors are able to do, are trained to do, and would like to do legally. We recognize that there was some unfinished business, and we certainly can understand that they want to have the freedom to do what they can do. And that, you know, there should be probably some framework for them to do more than they're allowed to do under 146A. So the question is how to get there, and how to get there without stepping on the turf of other people who enjoy the freedom to practice, like the traditional naturopaths. And so that's really, I think, the trick. And one nod in that direction was Representative Abler's amendment to allow the word naturopath to remain in 146A. There's a lot of those practitioners who are just calling themselves naturopaths, traditional naturopaths. And so we want to make sure, I think, that whatever goes forward is not going to become a step backwards for the health freedom for traditional naturopaths. Our attorney Diane Miller was out sick today. She could not attend meetings with Representative Walker. And I think there's more time needed to hammer out a little more assurance that this will not be a step backwards for traditional naturopaths. So I really want to emphasize that that's a big concern, because everyone who has the freedom to practice now should not suffer a step backwards. So I think we're all willing to work hard on this, and hopefully Diane Miller is going to be back on her feet and able to meet and talk about the technical issues. There was language that she put forth in the pink text on several pieces of paper. Most of that language is not in this bill, not in this version, and a lot of it really is just trying to assure that people presently able to practice as traditional naturopaths are not going to be, their rights are not going to be impaired by the bill that might go forward to help the naturopathic medical doctors. So thank you for your interest in this. I think the mood here is to move forward for alternative and natural health care. I think all of us applaud that, and think it's wonderful, and I hope we can work together to find something that is more reassuring for the traditional naturopath. So the traditional naturopaths are, in my experience, some of the outstanding practitioners in our state, and they do a lot of amazing, wonderful things that are just simply kind of low-tech and very, very safe, which is why those people can continue to do that and be unlicensed. So we want to be sure and protect their rights and their freedoms to practice. And this is good policy for the consumers of our state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we have the, I guess, Ms. Walensky, and have Mr. Schmidt and Ms. Holm also at the table for the questioning portion. Before we move into that, I'm going to ask counsel to, originally this bill was to license, and have moved a lot towards just registering. Can Ms. Ayers, can you kind of give us, even though we're on the licensing committee, many of us don't know the difference between licensure and registration. Can you explain just a layman's description of that, the difference between the two?
Mr. Chair and members, as I understand it, there are like three different levels. There's certification at the, I don't want to say bottom level, but requires usually less qualification. Next comes registration, and finally is licensure. Individuals are licensed to protect public. People are also registered to protect the public, but it's my understanding that they do not provide the same type of treatments that could be as dangerous to the public as those that are licensed. People that are certified are individuals who have to abide by a patient's bill of rights and have to inform their clients or patients that they are functioning under a bill of rights, but there's no set qualifications that they have to show that they have fulfilled.
Thank you. I'm sorry I put you on this spot, but I think that helps clarify as we move forward. I do have a question for either Mr. Schmidt or Ms. Holmes. With the amendment that Representative Abler put in, would this bill moving forward limit you in what you are able to do today?
You should answer. I'm a carpenter, so it has no impact on me whatsoever.
Thank you. We'll have Ms. Holmes take on that. I hope it doesn't.
I really had a problem.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ms. Holmes.
Licensure and registration are to protect the public from dangerous things. And now that the medical board has removed from the bill the dangerous things, they are now able to practice under 46A. There's not 146A, which we passed in 2000. So there's no reason to add a layer of legislation of registration in the state of Minnesota when now all they have are listed are what they can do under 146A.
Oh, no, the question was, would it prevent you from practicing?
Well, we have tried for a year to get this language. We tried all last week, and we didn't get it till 1 o'clock today, and then the amendments were now. We haven't had a chance to review it line by line, word by word, so I really can't answer that until we can do that. And this is what consistent pattern is happening. We need to be going to the table, and we can all look at it before we come to a hearing like this and waste all of our time. That's all I can say. I don't know. I have to look at it line by line.
Maybe I'll direct that same question to Ms. Levinsky. Would it limit the folks who are in similar situation as Ms. Holmes from continuing to do what they do if this bill passed and moves forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there are two issues at hand. There are two issues as far as the amendments go from the people that are representing, or that Ms. Hone is representing. One of them is the term naturopathy, which Representative Abler made an amendment on. That was an issue that we feel has been addressed tonight. The second issue was whether or not we would be willing to put in language in our bill that would not restrict or not take away the right of the people that already practice under 146A from doing what they're already doing. And we agreed, and we put that language into our bill. The language didn't get back to us until late. If that's the way it is, that's the way it's been this week. So it's unfortunate that it's been that way. We haven't had it either. So,
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the testimony is not quite accurate. I mean, this is my fourth year carrying the bill. I carried it 2 years, and then Representative Abler carried it 2 years, and then I carried it these last 2 years. And it's not that we have not been meeting with individuals that have been concerned about this particular language. The issue is, have I thus far accepted the language? And the answer is no. And so it's not that we haven't been meeting and discussing and trying to figure out a compromise that's this far. Now, as it relates to language coming in a late hour, I'll be honest, this morning was the first time that I've seen the language and the change in the amendment that's before you. I was okay with moving it and this evening because my understanding was what was in the bill. The only difference really was changing the words licensure to registered. What was in the bill is what you had. The amendment that was adopted that the MMA wanted took out some of the language that was in the amendment and in the bill from last year. So the bill really hasn't changed. The bill really is the same bill outside of we're not going to ask for licensure at this time. We're asking for registration, which is what the chair has requested us to do.
Thank you, Representative Walker. I'm still waiting for my answer.
And so your answer to your question, no, they could still practice. The thing is that this group would still be recognized as the registered individuals in the practice.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can help. The original bill from last February of 2007 protects basically the same terms and names of what you want to call yourself as does the new bill. All a licensure bill really does is protect the title who can call themselves something. You can't call yourself a chiropractor, all right, without having achieved a credential. There are no unlicensed chiropractors in Minnesota. You can call yourself a counselor if you want, because there's no protection of the word counselor. If you're going to be a licensed professional counselor, you have to have a credential for that, and the law says what that is. In the case of this bill, there are three titles that are protected: registered naturopathic doctor, naturopathic doctor, or doctor of naturopathic medicine. If you want to call yourself anything else that doesn't apply to registered, you can call yourself anything else you want. You can call yourself a naturopath. You can call yourself a really cool naturopath. You can call yourself a super-duper naturopath. And those titles are unprotected and not governed by this bill at all. Any use of the word naturopath, except for the in terms of registration, is protected only by the what I put back in, so people can still do that. Now, I just have to offer a comment, though, to the opponents. In Minnesota, we like our knowledge of what people are trained as. And there's a high bar in this bill to call yourself a registered naturopathic doctor or a naturopathic doctor or a doctor of naturopathic medicine. If you want to use that term on this bill, you have to achieve the level of training. Only 26 people in the state have achieved. That doesn't minimize the value of the other people who are doing this. But I have to tell you, the range of people who do that range from people who took one course to those who have been working for 20 years or longer. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the people don't know what they're getting. So if you want to get the credential that this bill has, you have to get a person who has this title. If you use this title, you have to achieve these credentials. That's the entire point of the bill. And so if the people like you and you're doing naturopathy to help them out, nothing is stopping that. And so that's the purpose of the bill. And so I think it's begging for some meetings. It sounds like everybody wants to meet. And I think the meeting's going to happen real darn soon. And then you can discuss, you want to say that this does not include the title of various titles you want to exclude by saying they're excluded. That'll give you comfort, but that's pretty comfort because those words aren't included as protected titles now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What we'll go with... I forgot your name, ma'am. And then we'll go with Mr. Schmidt after that.
I just want to, as a medical doctor, from my perspective, I think the value of the registration for naturopaths is that we're acknowledging and providing a safety net for a group of individuals, 26 of them in the state, that we know that they have been trained in an accredited school. And I think that's incredible value for me as a physician when I look at referrals. And I think you can't lose that the understanding that that is the value that we're trying to create here.
Okay. Just for the record, that was Dr. Torkelson. Mr. Schmidt, go ahead.
Let me respond to a couple of comments. First, if I recall correctly, the disclosure form that a natural health practitioner, again, I'm a carpenter, so I may be rusty on this, the form that the person has to get is the level of education, if any, to the client beforehand. So the client gets all that information. They get to make an intelligent decision. I hate to say this, but I think a lot of times licensure bills assume that the public is stupid. We're not stupid. I can tell by reading and asking questions and doing a lot of other things who is and who is not somebody I might want to work with. And if they don't fulfill my need, then I go to somebody else. If I want to have a painter come and work on one of my carpentry projects, I have painters come to work on my carpentry projects, and the people who do good work continue to work, and the people who don't do good work don't get called again. And I think the issue of the education assumes that somehow or another what you learn inside those four walls you retain forever. I can tell you that the people I know are inveterate students. They are sponges for getting more and more information all the time. So I think there's an old adage that says something that education doesn't stop at the door, it begins at the door. And so I think saying that these people have gone to a school that had bricks and mortar versus people who didn't go to a school that had bricks and mortar is presuming a lot that may not be true.
Ms. Holmes?
I'm sorry, Doctor, I didn't get your name. Dr. Torkelson, with all due respect, I understand what you're saying, but the 26 are allowed to promote themselves with their educations and their degrees to the physicians in the community, which they can refer to. They know who they are. And the non-traditional naturopaths, who, by the way, you have to tie to a chair with duct tape and hide their checkbook to keep them from continuing their learning, as well as the other naturopaths who crave learning, right? I mean, we all want to learn and be the best that we can. And so we understand there's a differentiation here. We applaud you. We appreciate you. We want you to have what you want, but not in this way. And we're hoping that the committee tonight will say, both sides, please go back to the table where we have been wanting to be, and the story of Walker. It's not just about you, it's about the whole group. We want them, our colleagues, to sit down at a table, all of us, and make nice. We don't have to be waiting till a hearing and fight like this. We've been fighting for 11 years. We're tired of it. And we want to make Minnesota the best state that it can be to have those kinds of natural health practitioners. So Dr. Torkelson is comfortable with who she refers to, but, you know, they can already practice legally, they can promote themselves, I'm sure they have a list that they can circulate within the medical community so they're comfortable with who they're referring to. Without licensure, this is another layer, a costly another layer to have a registration we don't need. They're already made legal.
Thank you. I think Representative Abler does have a point. The state does have an obligation to protect the public, and I don't think it's a lot to ask to register those who have gone through many years of education. I think it's a good step in the right direction. We have had a lot of testimony already, and I think I'm going to move ahead to get this voter on and move on. We'll give you a couple seconds. Go ahead.
We proved in 2000 that legislation or licensure does not protect the public. We have vast documents that show this. It does not protect the public. So if that's where you're going, and the reason for it is different than Dr. Torkelson talked about. And so I would beg that you study that before you make a decision.
Thank you. Those members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I in my second year on the licensing subcommittee, I'm working hard to discipline myself to assure that we are doing our job in protecting the public while not fencing in unnecessarily. And I am really delighted to hear tonight that there is a commitment to proceeding with some discussions on the topic. I know this is an important issue to Mr. Schmidt and Ms. Hone, who are my neighbors, and I've spoken with Representative Walker, and I am convinced in her efforts to try and resolve the issues. I'm committed to working with her, and I just wanted to be on the record with that. Thank you.
Mr. Kassman is actually my constituent also, so it's not just Representative Murphy here. You know, I actually, if you look in District 61, we probably have one of the most diverse and variety of naturopaths and other forms of natural medicines being practiced and being consumed by consumers and patients. And so it's just that I do think these 26 individuals should be registered tonight.
I renew my motion with recommend to pass as amended House File 1724 to Health Human Service Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Bill is adopted. Thank you. I believe I'm next.
Okay, Representative Ms. Powell, would you like to move your House File 3247?
Yes, Madam Chair, I want to move House File 3247 to the Committee of Health and Service Policy. You know, as we move forward with
you have an A1 amendment. Should we take that up at this town time to get it in the bill in the shape that you'd like to have it in?
Why don't we go ahead and do that? I believe this amendment has been worked out with some of the groups.
The groups met with the Minnesota Dental Association and took some suggestions and some concerns, and this is our response to some of those suggestions. So there are some variations to just kind of tighten up the collaborative agreement by adding words like written. And then there's a new subsection that identifies the membership of an advisory committee, which is comprised of more parties of interest, the Board of Dentistry, as well as the University of Minnesota Dental School, and national and international experts as well. So a new section on a new advisory committee.
So this will be the office amendment. I also can get the bill in the shape that I wanted. I move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is...
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. As we move forward with our health care policy, been in the health policy for the last 6 years, I believe. I know that it's very difficult for members of the community, members of Minnesotans to get access to health, to dental care. And I think in our package, I included a letter from someone who has nothing at stake, but is a consumer of health care, and he explains the predicament and why we need this bill. But I've been here 6 years, and here's my big concern. Currently, if you are sick, you can walk into a hospital without medical assistance, or without health insurance, really, and you could get access to the ER, to the doctors to help you out, and you could walk out of there, and then you usually end up having that become charity care and what have you. But if your teeth ache and you have medical assistance, you cannot, and you do not get an appointment at a dentist's office, you cannot go. And so a lot of times folks end up in the ER, which is very, very expensive for the state to cover. And so a lot of folks who have only medical assistance or even on Minnesota care do not have access to dental care. And that is one of the driving reasons why I'm supporting this bill and pushing this forward. The testifiers will explain the bill a little bit better and give you a better understanding of why we have this need. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Anderson. I've been a licensed dental hygienist for almost 37 years and an educator at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry for 20. I'm a past president of the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association and currently the liaison to the Minnesota Board of Dentistry for the Minnesota Dental Hygiene Educators Association. And my job today is to review the provisions of House File 3247. House File 3247 creates an advanced dental hygiene practitioner who provides primary oral health services, and those services include diagnostic, educational, prescriptive, palliative, therapeutic, and restorative. The ADHP would provide all of these services currently under the dental hygiene scope of practice, and in addition, to provide those primary dental services which are in high demand, leaving more advanced needs to be provided by dentists. This practitioner would be to dentistry what the nurse practitioner is to medicine. The ADHP, or the advanced dental hygiene practitioner, must work under a written collaborative managed agreement with the dentist. This is not an unsupervised situation or independent practice. The ADHP must formulate individual care plans in collaboration with the patient and work cooperatively with the oral health care team as well as other health care professionals. The ADHP must be a licensed dental hygienist who successfully completes a master's degree program from an institution accredited by an agency recognized by the U.S. Department of Education to offer graduate level programs. I won't read through the minimum program requirements, but they do include management of urgent care and emergencies. The ADHP must be experienced at a minimum of 2,400 hours of experience as a dental hygienist and must complete coursework in infection control and emergency management and must pass a comprehensive competency-based clinical examination developed in consultation and approved by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. The ADHP must have this written collaborative agreement with the dentist, and the protocols are specified in the language. This section requires the individual dentist and ADHP to develop a management agreement that is particular to them, including patient review, treatment protocols, care review, record management, referral, quality assurance, and an emergency plan for consultation and transfer to a dentist. The agreement must be reviewed and updated annually and available to the Board of Dentistry upon request. Subdivision 3 contains language addressing this section in 158.061 and addresses the selection, prescribing, dispensing, and administering of drugs and medications for therapy, pain management, and prevention that's related and appropriate to the practice of the ADHP. I mentioned the advisory committee being established, and that's also a new subsection. The subsection of 158.10, subsection 1B, identifies the services that the ADHP may provide. The ADHP may formulate a diagnosis within their scope of practice, may prepare teeth for restoration, place temporary and permanent restorations, treat diseased teeth, and remove teeth with pressing emergent needs within specific guidelines and protocols. The ADHP, as I said, may prescribe, administer, and dispense medications as identified in the individual collaborative management agreement with that dentist. The ADHP may also work with dental assistants and other dental hygienists who may provide their scope of practice as authorized by this chapter or by the board. And under a collaborative management agreement, the ADHP may see the patients first and may practice without the presence of the dentist
which currently does exist for collaborative practice and general supervision, but will collaborate, consult, and coordinate care with the dentist and other healthcare professionals, and will provide referrals as needed for more advanced care. The last part of this bill amends Minnesota Statute 2007 Supplement Section 151.37 Subdivision 2 to allow for the prescription, administering, and dispensing of the drugs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And additional proponents or
at this time, we'd actually like all of you to come down so we can move quickly, because in terms of the 15-minute rule that I'll still follow our chair's rule, we have until 8:30. So if you could just be ready to go back to back. Thank you, and introduce yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Suzanne Beatty. I'm a dentist who is a dental educator. I've educated dental assistants, dental hygienists, and dental students. I'm also a provider of dental services in a community dental clinic. I'm one of six dentists on Metropolitan State University's advisory committee to develop the curriculum for the master's program leading to the advanced dental hygiene practitioner. Please let me briefly do an overview of this curriculum. First, applicants to this master's program must have a baccalaureate degree, hold a dental hygiene license, have 2,400 hours of clinical practice. This is beyond 600 clinical hours the hygienists obtained during their undergraduate degree. The Metropolitan State University's master's degree leading to the ADHP is composed of approximately one-third interdisciplinary courses. These courses will be taught by doctoral faculty members, and they will address public health, public policy, and research issues at the master's degree level. The remaining master's credits relate solely to dentistry. This part of the curriculum is being developed by the advisory committee for the master's program. The committee is composed of six dentists, each who has decades of experience in their field, and three healthcare professionals with doctorate degrees. The majority of the dentists on this committee have taught at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. The master's courses relating solely to dentistry are being developed by dentists and will be taught by dentists. The competencies that will be met by the master's level practitioner will be significant. More than 50 are set forth by the ADHA, the American Dental Hygiene Association, and beyond that, the appropriate American Dental Association's Commission on Dental Accreditation Standards competencies for the new dentist. These will serve as guidelines and outcome assessment measures for the advanced dental hygiene practitioner. The curriculum will go through a rigorous review within the university and will be subjected to external reviews by dental experts. This rigorous curriculum will create a mid-level dental hygiene practitioner with refined analytical skills, sound clinical judgment, and decision-making. The ADHP will be able to decide when a patient can be treated within their scope of practice, or when a patient needs referral to a dentist or a dental specialist for diagnosis and treatment. The advanced dental hygiene practitioner, working under a collaborative management agreement with a dentist, could be the foundation for managing untreated dental disease and for improving the oral health of the citizens of Minnesota, particularly children, elderly, special needs patients, and other populations without access to dental care. In closing, I want to assure you that Metropolitan State University's master's program for the ADHP will result in highly competent dental professionals that will ensure safe treatment to patients without compromising quality of care. Upon their graduation, I would allow any of these practitioners to work on me or a member of my family. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next, go ahead. Introduce yourself to the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Kozart. I'm a collaborative practice dental hygienist, certified in restorative functions. I have 20 years of clinical practice experience as a hygienist. For almost 7 years now, I have worked for Sharing and Caring Hands, and I have been involved in collaborative practice for nearly 4 of those years. I'm here tonight to tell you about the unmet needs I see and why I urge you to support this bill. Every day, people in pain and desperate for dental care wait in line for hours for the chance to see one of our volunteer dentists. I wish I had time to tell you just some of their stories. Many of these people have already been to the emergency room. The dedicated dentists and oral surgeons who volunteer their time and talent are angels, and they do all they can to help these people. That generally means removing a tooth or the teeth that are causing the pain. But almost everyone we see has extensive dental needs, which we have to ignore because we only have time to take out the tooth that hurts the most today. Too often, there are more people than we can see, and some people are turned away. The number of people we see and the extent of their unmet needs and the number of people we turn away is truly overwhelming. And there's more. One or two evenings a week, I go across the street to the shelter where I use portable equipment to provide preventive services to the homeless kids who stay there. I started doing this about 9 months ago in hopes of saving them from the fate I just described. But I quickly discovered that many of these kids already have decay. Some of them have a lot of decay, and some are in pain. But many have problems that right now could be treated with restoration. But I cannot help use my restorative skills to help these kids, because there is no dentist to do the drilling. And every time a child leaves my chair with untreated cavities, I know that we all have missed an opportunity. And all I can think is, I should have done something. And that's why I want to be an ADHD. The current system just is not working for too many people. The time has come for us to find alternative methods of delivering care to them. Collaborative practice does allow hygienists like myself to bring preventive services directly to disadvantaged and vulnerable populations, but these people need and deserve more from us. They need basic primary care. This crisis calls on all of us to do our part, so I ask you to support this bill so that I and other hygienists who share my passion and commitment can do ours. I know that I cannot save the world, but I believe that I can make a world of difference to these kids that I see. Please understand, I'm not talking here about taking patients or livelihood from practicing dentists. I am talking about people who currently have no dental home. This is not about replacing dentists or competing with them, and it certainly is not about lowering the standards of care. It is about providing care for people, basic, easily accessible care for people who otherwise are not going to receive it. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kozart, for that testimony. It's very good to hear from the front lines of what we're dealing with. This. We have, on your time plan, we have 3 minutes left, so the three of you. So
I have
brief comments.
I have some an additional handout and letters to page to be distributed. Madam Chair, my name is Mary Syro. I am the director of the dental clinic at Hennepin County Medical Center. I've been in practice for 20 years. I'm also an educator. I direct a residency program that trains graduates of dental school dentists to practice in a hospital and work with complex patients that have medical problems and disabilities. I'm testifying on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition, and HCMC is part of the coalition.
I support this bill because it's going to make it possible for thousands of patients to obtain care who cannot get it today. This cost to not providing this dental care. A study done by Dr. Amos Steinhardt, a pediatrician at the university, looked at 5 metro area hospitals to determine costs associated with ER visits. And he found that in a 1-year period, there were over 10,000 visits related to an uncomplicated dental diagnosis. The average charge per visit was $459, and the total charges were $4.7 million. And these are medical charges. Patients treated in ERs do not get definitive care. They get pain meds and antibiotics. And as a result, nearly 40% of those seen return again to the emergency room. At HCMC Dental Clinic, we extract over 10,000 teeth per year. About 1/3 of the visits to our urgent care are dental-related. We get 1,200 phone calls a week, patients looking for dental care, and 50% of those are looking for emergency care. We don't have enough dentists and resources to take care of even a fraction of these patients. We see people who end up in the ICU for a month because of life-threatening infections that result from a tooth that could have been a simple extraction. We see about 2,000 developmentally disabled patients. They come from all over the state, Duluth, Wilmer, Windham, Marshall, to name a few. We, for years, have searched unsuccessfully for ways to improve access to dental care for the underserved. Preventive measures are great, but these patients' needs are far beyond this. You cannot put a Band-Aid over a gaping wound. It's time to take measures that will help significantly to increase the number of willing and able dental providers, and this model has been shown to be successful and safe, and I urge you to put it into action.
Thanks very much, Ms. Stoinek. Dr. Amundson or Dr. Ebert?
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. I'm a dentist, and I'm the dental director for Health Partners. My personal practice with Health Partners is focused 100% on the Medicaid population. In 1985, or maybe it was 1983, I was appointed to my first legislative task force on dental access. I've been on federal or state task forces continuously since that time, and the problem has been intractable. I'll be the first to admit that basic dental care, primary dental care, is not simple dental care. And I want to acknowledge that there are fears of developing a tiered system through this program. I serve as a member of the advisory committee on the curriculum, and I want to assure you that the Metropolitan State University is taking great care in developing the faculty and curriculum to support this program, and it has my full confidence. I recollect when I started at Group Health in the old days as a dentist, I felt from my colleagues that I was in a kind of a practice that was a second-tier practice. I knew better. My assumption is that in the future, somebody will look back at these old days and understand that the kind of care that advanced dental hygiene practitioners provide is not going to be second-tier dentistry. It'll be top-drawer dentistry. Health Partners and my support for this legislation is contingent on a robust collaborative management agreement. We think that the language appropriately places control and responsibility in the hands of the dentist, that it provides care that is delegated within the context of a collaborative management agreement, and that the dentist in that agreement will be held appropriately accountable for care protocols, quality review, quality assurance, support for complex patients, and assurance that capability and processes exist to deal with the unexpected complications that may occur. I urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Amundson. And Dr. Ebert, we are over time, but I will give you 1 minute to add some final comments.
Madam Chair, my name is Carl Ebert. I'm a dentist that practices at a dental clinic in St. Paul called Community Dental Care. We serve those that otherwise wouldn't receive care. I want to state that in my years here working at the Capitol on dental access, this is the bill that I feel represents the best hope for dental access for the underserved in Minnesota. My task here is to talk a little bit about safety. I'll cut this very short. We've seen studies in Canada, Great Britain, and even here in the U.S. that have shown that dental therapists and specifically trained dental hygienists have provided care at the same standard, if not higher, than practicing dentists. I have a quote that I think sums it up very well. This is from a report from the University of Washington doing a site visit up in Alaska from 2005, where dental therapists were trained in New Zealand and provided care for the native Alaskans there. This is his. These are his words. In every respect, their performance met the standard of care I had established. Each is equipped not only to provide essential preventive services, but simple treatments involving irreversible dental procedures such as fillings and extractions. Their patient management skills surpass the standard of care. They know the limits of their scope of practice and at no time demonstrated any willingness to exceed them. On multiple occasions, they demonstrated their ability to recognize and avoid clinical situations that might pose a threat to patient safety. My first-hand observations convince me that statements made by dentists and dental societies suggesting that dental therapists cannot be trained to provide competent and safe primary care for Native Alaskans are overstated. Perhaps the most relevant fact that I found was that in no place could I find any studies that showed the dental therapist provided the standard of care lower than that of dentists. In conclusion, numerous other countries for decades have proven that the approach in this bill is safe and effective. If we are to seriously address our state's worsening dental access crisis, I would strongly urge your passage of this bill. I think Minnesota's underserved deserve this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Eden. And now the opponents, Dr. Lingle, Dr. Lloyd, Patricia Stone, Charity Dean, if you could all come up. Again, we'll start the clock for approximately 17 minutes, to be fair. And go ahead.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Dr. Scott Lingle. I'm a general dentist here in St. Paul, and I'm representing the Minnesota Dental Association. There is a dental access problem for a number of people, and this is not a new problem. The dentists of Minnesota have been working on this for many years, and we will continue to do so. We are seeing the public program patients and the underserved every day in our practices, and that is why their safety is our primary concern. It doesn't matter whether I see a bank president in my office or when I'm extracting teeth at the Union Gospel Mission in St. Paul, I deliver the same quality of care and the same expertise to every patient. This bill talks about simple fillings and extractions. I guess all medical procedures are simple, so something goes wrong. And if you don't have the in-depth knowledge and training to even know that something is wrong, it's a much worse situation. I've been in the middle of doing simple upper molar extractions and had the patient feel some pain in her cheekbone. That's because the maxillary bone is fused or the tooth was fracturing. This goes from a simple to a complex surgical extraction in less than a second. Another problem with upper extractions is the rupturing of the floor of the sinus. Many people's roots extend up into the floor of the sinus, and I don't want anybody starting something that you can't finish safely. And having a management agreement by cell phone with some well-intentioned dentist is not going to do that. They talk about supervision, but there's not supervision in this bill. There is not a dentist there supervising. Broken root tips during an extraction are also an expected complication by any dentist that does extractions. You have to have well-trained surgical skills to finish the job safely. What about simple fillings? X-rays are a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional object. I often find decay is deeper than I expected from what I read on the film. If you cut preparations for fillings, you eventually have to expose the nerve tissue and need to do a root canal. If you don't, you will have a severe abscess on your hand. Other times, you'll need to be able to diagnose an internal crack and switch from a filling to a crown. But if all you have is a hammer, doesn't everything start to look like a nail? The physics, the retention, design form, and chemistry of any successful filling are the result of many complex factors learned during an in-depth dental education. It's not just cutting a hole and filling it up. When Dr. Patricia Kingston was doing a simple periodontal treatment in my office, she noted a variation in the tissue she was working with. She immediately biopsied the area, and it came back from the pathologist as squamous cell carcinoma. This lady lost a large part of her jaw, but she lived because of the quick diagnosis. This is where we keep the quality at a significant level. Dr. Michael Schaffhauser in our office is the dentist for the Special Olympics. He takes many of these handicapped patients to the hospital for general anesthesia during their dental treatment. He's doing simple fillings, but he knows the complexity of the medical histories of these patients and knows when not to attempt the treatment in the office. When we talk about public program patients and the underserved, this population frequently is the most medically compromised segment of people. This is not the group of people that should be seen by a lesser-trained professional. We all want to help the access problem. The entire dental profession, dentists, hygienists, assistants, educators, even patient care groups like nursing homes, Head Start programs, and the entire medical community have not had the time to discuss this program. We haven't discussed the benefits or the pitfalls. Even the state's own agencies, the Board of Dentistry and the Department of Human Services, have not had time to really contemplate or contribute on this. We can't discover all of this in a 15-minute discussion tonight. I strongly urge you not to advance this bill this year and give us the time to meet and look at this properly. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next witness.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm Patrick Lloyd, Dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. I spent several years in the beginning of my career practicing dentistry in underserved communities in the city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and working as a dentist for the VA Medical Center's long-term care programs. I've practiced in public and private nursing homes throughout the Midwest. As a faculty member of two different dental schools and as dean, I'm passionate about providing our dental and dental hygiene students with an education that is concerned with the community and committed to caring. I'm also committed to graduating dental professionals who provide quality care and service to all Minnesotans. The University of Minnesota School of Dentistry educates general dentists, dental hygienists, and specialists. We're the only dental school between Milwaukee and Seattle. Our dental hygiene program is one of only two in the state of Minnesota that offers a baccalaureate degree and the only dental hygiene program in the state that educates dental hygienists along with dental dentist students. I'm here today to provide information on how we prepare dentists to practice dentistry. Since our graduates work with all members of the dental team, it is in our vested interest to ensure that competency is existing at all levels of care to safeguard the health of the public. I'll limit my comments to the following subjects: prerequisites for getting into dental school, educational training offered to perform the treatments as outlined in the bill, the process by which all U.S. dental and dental hygiene programs are accredited, and requirements for state licensure for dental professionals. Prerequisites to enter dental school at the University of Minnesota is an intensive college curriculum, minimum of 87 semester credit hours, including general biology or zoology, physics, general principles in chemistry, inorganic and organic chemistry, biochemistry, mathematics, applied human physiology. There's a standardized entrance exam that tests competencies in basic sciences, reading comprehension, quantitative reasoning. Perceptual ability. There's a personal interview with a member of our admissions team to evaluate communication skills, social awareness, general life expectations, and motivations for the dental practice. Our educational experiences to train dentists in order to perform bills outlined in service include significant classroom instruction and clinical experience related to oral surgical procedures. This includes the anatomy of teeth and the adjacent structures, assessment of patients prior to surgical procedures, selections of x-rays and interpretation of those x-rays for both adults and children, management of common post-surgical consequences such as pain and infection, instrumentation and surgical procedures related to the extraction of teeth. And there are clinical hours associated with each of these disciplines: oral radiology, oral surgery, and pediatric dentistry. In reference to the tooth surgical procedures identified in the bill, our coursework provides clinical experiences for our students in judging when and how to drill and restore teeth in both children and adults. In addition to instruction in the external surfaces of teeth, there is also coursework on the internal anatomy of teeth that includes different layers of tooth structure as well as the tooth pulp. Other instructions include studying physical properties and clinical indications for the use of different filling materials, white filling materials, silver filling materials. The remainder of the instruction includes materials on drilling procedures and the placement of fillings. Clinical procedures to demonstrate competency to these clinical performances are extensive and lengthy. In order for us to adequately educate our students to perform procedures described in this bill, we need specialized classroom and clinical training facilities and expertise of faculty or dentists with advanced training. To accomplish this goal, we have approximately 110 full-time faculty, the majority of whom are dentists with advanced training, representing the disciplines of dental materials, oral surgery, operative dentistry, root canal specialists, and pediatric dentistry. The accreditation process of our school that provides training for dentists and dental hygienists are regularly evaluated and accredited for their ability to meet the standards as required to. It's conducted by the Commission on Dental Accreditation, an independent third body made up of examiners from throughout the country. Each state board recognizes this independent third-party review to provide objective evaluation and assessment of educational programming. In reference to licensure, as part of the requirement to gain licensure in Minnesota, dental graduates must be examined by a testing agency approved by the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. At the present time, our students take a three-part examination that, one, tests hand-eye coordination to perform specified procedures, two, a full-day computer-based examination evaluating students' abilities to diagnose and treatment plan myriad dental conditions, and three, a clinical examination where candidates for licensure provide select procedures on patients. Performance is assessed by a group of calibrated clinicians from states around the country who also accept the examination that our board accepts. The wealth of experience and expertise at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry is available to the people of Minnesota and its representatives as a source of information and discussions that affect oral health care to Minnesotans. We have a long-standing commitment to improving health of Minnesotans by educating the next generation of dental professionals of all sorts in a variety of initiatives for both pride providing care to the underserved and introducing students to the responsibilities they will have as professionals. We stand ready as a school to continue to serve as a resource to the broader community, and I thank you for the opportunity to explain how it is that we educate dentists so that we can be of assistance as we move forward with this particular bill and legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. And who would like to go next, Patricia Stone or Charity Dean Nelson?
I can go next.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself to the tape.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Patricia Stone. I've been a licensed dental hygienist here in Minnesota for almost 12 years now. I'm in my third year of dental school at the University of Minnesota, and I continue to practice dental hygiene. I'm here tonight to tell you about my experience as I transitioned from a dental hygienist to a dental student and explain my opposition to House File 3247. In 1996, I obtained my dental hygiene license and began to practice full-time in a private dental office in Virginia, Minnesota, up on the Iron Range. During my first 5 years of practice, I remember observing the dentist I was working with as they diagnosed their patient's conditions and presented various treatment options to our patients. There were many times that I did not agree with the proposed treatment and felt that I would have stressed different treatment plans. A few more years went by, and I decided that I wanted to be that person offering restorative advice to my patients. So I began my journey to dental school. At first, I couldn't understand why the dental program would require me to retake certain science courses and why I had to expand my undergraduate courses to include higher sciences. But I realized I had to jump through those hoops if I wanted to become a dentist. Even into my first 2 years at dental school, I felt that taking some of the anatomy, histology, embryology, and other courses were just really not necessary to treat patients' needs. It was not until the start of my third year when I began to treat real live patients that I realized how critical those dental school courses had been for my patient safety. We were required to prepare a plastic teeth. There were so many times that I made mistakes. When working on live human beings, there are no room for such mistakes. But along with my fellow classmates, I spent many hours practicing during our preclinical courses. We then completed competency exams that must be passed prior to treating live patients. Now, every day in clinic, I am reminded that those basic dental school courses that I had so reluctantly taken, which were far more in-depth than those I had taken in my dental hygiene program, were absolutely essential. I'm learning how to treat medically compromised patients, how to critically evaluate research and techniques on new products and techniques, how to safely prescribe medications, how to treat emergency patients, and how to provide advice to my patients about a wide variety of appropriate treatment options. It is my responsibility to first do no harm. I know that comprehensive dental education I'm receiving is preparing me to treat the public in a safe and effective manner, and I am eagerly looking forward to returning to the Iron Range to practice dentistry when I graduate and get licensed. In conclusion,
I was shocked when I read this bill. having practiced as a dental hygienist before dental school, I can easily understand why this bill might appeal to hygienists, but I do not believe it does justice to either profession, and I strongly urge you to vote against it.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Go ahead. Ms. Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Charity Jean Nelson, but my friends call me CJ. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you this evening and share my concerns about the House File 3247. I am a third-year dental student at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. I am also a licensed, actively practicing dental hygienist and have been since 1999. If anyone had asked me what I thought of the Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner Program before I began dental school, I would have told them I thought it was a great idea. At the time, I thought that with my dental hygiene education and career, I had an appreciable understanding of dentistry. An ADHP program would have offered me an advancement in dental hygiene and would have reduced some of the monotony of a traditional dental hygiene practice. I personally would have taken advantage of this ADHP program. It wasn't until I began dental school at the University of Minnesota that I realized how naive I had been. Dentistry is extremely comprehensive and complex. Based on what I know now, I don't believe I would have been appropriately prepared to safely serve the public with anything less than the in-depth education I am now receiving at the university. I can't imagine trying to make a final diagnosis and an adequate dental treatment plan without the education I am getting at the dental school. I know there is a need for dentists to serve rural communities. My husband and I have our permanent residence in northern rural Minnesota, and I fully intend to practice in the same area when I graduate and become licensed. I believe that all people deserve to have access to quality care from professionals they trust. Personally, I believe there is a crisis in the dental access, but I do not believe that creating an advanced dental hygiene practitioner as described in this bill will do anything to solve that problem, and in fact, I think it will put patients at risk. I urge you to vote no to this bill. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Nelson. And we now are can both sides now gather up at front, or at least in that vicinity, and we will move to questions of either anybody who is presented at this time from the member. Okay, we're going to start with Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions. I think I'll just start and then maybe others have questions. I can hold off some of the others. And I'm not certain who's the most appropriate person to answer this, so whomever. There's probably a number of you that can. Someone earlier in the testimony said that the ADHP is a proven safe treatment. And my first question is, how many other states have ADHP programs right now?
There are no other states that have an ADHP program right now.
That's not exactly true. The state of Alaska uses ADHP.
Can you identify yourself with the
My
tape?
My name is Dr. Carl Ebert.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's true of all of you. If when you answer a question, please give your name. Okay. Dr. Norton, you want to go for this?
Well, I would like to hear. I couldn't hear in the microphone the second response, so I would like to hear that, please.
The truth is the state of Alaska has used ADHPs for their Native American populations, and the quote that I read to you is a quote from the evaluation of that program by the University of Washington faculty.
Patrick Lloyd, a dental school. They're not technically ADHP graduates. They are dental therapists trained outside of the United States to provide care in the Alaska area, but they're not technically, there are no technically advanced dental hygiene programs accredited in the United States.
I'd also like to add that all the dental therapists in several countries across the world do not have a master's degree like the ADHP would. There are also two states currently proposing legislation for the same model.
Thank you. One of the concerns that I've had raised by numerous, and I have a stack of emails that I've received, I quit printing them out at one point, And one couple issues have come forward, concerns that have been raised have to do with the drilling extraction, some of what we heard here, and also the prescriptions. Can you tell me currently, is anyone in the dental area able to do prescriptions, and what kind of prescription rights do dentists currently have?
Dentists have very similar prescription writing as to physicians, you know, antibiotics, pain control medications, you know, treatment of salivary diseases, you know, many different things like that. If you have advanced training, you can use sedation medications, things like that. Right now, no other person below the degree of a dentist would have prescription writing capabilities.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So this is going to be completely new for the entire dental hygienist, dental assistant realm, this prescription right?
Right. This would be the first time in the country.
I did have one more.
May I make a comment on that? Currently within the dental hygiene scope of practice as it is right now, they are not permitted to prescribe fluoride or sealants, which is both within their scope of practice. So, and also under the collaborative management agreement, it would be agreed between the dentist and the ADHP what type of prescriptions could be written.
Madam Chair, and I'm having a little bit of confusion between the previously, recently, 2001, authorized collaborative practice and the collaborative management agreement. So what you just referred to was?
Collaborative management agreement.
Okay, so the current collaborative authorization practice, sealants, are not
correct.
Being done by?
No, they are being done by, but they cannot be prescribed by a dental
okay. hygienist. So under the current collaborative agreement, sealants could be put on because you're working in a collaborative with the dentist?
Yes.
Okay. So then my last question, Madam Chair, for now, had to do with the dentist on-site issue, which I don't know that you, the first testifiers handled directly in their testimony, but was alluded to later on, and as I understand it, with the advanced dental hygienist practitioner with the collaborative management agreement, it is not a requirement that there be a dentist on site, but that there will be coordination with a dentist. Is that correct?
Dr. Lingle, yes, that is correct. There is no dentist on site. There is no supervision.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I didn't mean to usurp your power there and invite her down, but I...
Madam Chair, Dean Anderson, I just wanted to comment that under the current limited authorization for dental hygienists who provide preventive therapies, that they are currently under a collaborative agreement as well, as you know, but in those collaborative agreements, too, the dentist is not on the premises and has authorized the procedure. This is very similar. What's changing is the scope of practice and not so much the supervision. So we do currently have that working as best as we can right now. There's no problems, as I understand.
Without the drilling, the extractions, and the prescriptions, just with the coating. And, okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'll leave that for now.
Anyone else with questions? Mr. Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question, and this would be for, I guess, anybody on the panel who wants to offer it up. One of the concerns I've heard expressed is that a simple extraction or a simple procedure can become a complex procedure. And so I'm wondering, maybe especially from the dentist, if there are occasions when you begin a procedure and the procedure changes mid-course and you need to pack a tooth or postpone what you were planning to do in order to change your course of treatment, and how that plays out for the dental care and for the person receiving the care.
Go ahead, introduce yourself again.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. I guess I'd respond to that from maybe two perspectives. One, what the kind of situation that you would expect a advanced dental hygiene practitioner to undertake should be within the scope of the collaborative management agreement with the dentist.
and I, like many of my colleagues, would use a great deal of caution in identifying those kinds of procedures that that person could proceed with without specific authorization or review with me as the collaborating dentist. You know, in our practice, we have broad scope, and more directly to your question, broad scope dentists. We have narrow scope dentists. You know, some of us are just following almost any complication that come along out of a surgical procedure, and some dentists, when they find themselves with a complication that is beyond their scope, simply have to refer that patient to the appropriate provider to complete procedures. Sometimes that has to be same day, sometimes that subsequent day. But I think the key to patient safety is a well thought out collaborative management agreement that, number one, limits the practitioner to those things that are reasonably not likely to produce complications, and secondly, have alternative strategies in place to deal with those kinds of situations. And some of our systems that have electronic imaging, electronic records, remote access to records will be able to do that fairly easily. Some systems you would expect that you'd have to narrow the scope substantially in order to give appropriate oversight to the advanced dental hygiene practitioner.
Madam Chair, Dr. Lingle, let me find that too. Okay. In a previous testimony, it was talked about, you know, that extractions would be done in very specific situations, on any emergent situations, and a lot of criteria. And we just heard about the narrow scope of practice. Unfortunately, the bill says extractions. Mm-hmm. That's all it says. This is where we need to work this out. There's a lot of problems in this bill that are not being addressed. The language is what you have to deal with tonight, and that is not what's being addressed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got several questions. I think it's a compelling idea. I think those of us, I've been here 10 years, and I'm not sure if I'll make a lot in the way today is going, after my vote today, but anyway, here it is tonight we are. If you've been following the news. Today, here we are. But in the physician's assistance world, I believe when those came forward, I believe the world was going to end. And people would die. Mm-hmm. And terrible harm would happen. And actually, I think very little harm has happened. And I think because of the strength of the collaborative agreement, where a dentist is willing to let this newly trained person do something, I had a question about liability. And I guess the panel to just address, so who bears the liability? If something goes wrong, is it the dentist, or does the hygienist also have their own insurance? And their own liability. Is it both?
Go ahead, Dr.
Amundson. I'm not a lawyer. My name is Craig Amundson. I'm here. I'm glad you mentioned the physician's assistance. From my perspective, that's probably a more appropriate model from a licensing perspective than a nurse practitioner. Nurse practitioner practices under their own license, and they have to have physicians available to them in case they need some advice, whereas a physician assistant practices under the physician's license as is spelled out in their collaborative agreement. My operating assumption is that if I'm taking responsibility for that practitioner, and I'm going to be the one that will limit what they can or cannot be delegated, I assume that I'm on the hook from a professional liability perspective. I also assume as an organization we would want to make sure that the practitioner is covered as well, because I would assume anybody can get sued relative to that.
Currently, the Board of Dentistry does not require that anybody carry liability insurance, including the dentist. Just for your information, I carry my own liability insurance, even though I'm employed by the university and don't need it. But as a volunteer, I feel it's important. I called the insurance company that carries my policy and asked them about this, and they said that currently under their guidelines that anything a dental hygienist is licensed to do in the state is covered by liability insurance. I'm imagining that if I were an ADHP that my liability insurance costs would go significantly higher once this is in place. Right now I pay $80 a year, and I'm sure that would change, but I can provide local anesthesia, nitrous oxide, and anything else I do in my scope of practice for that amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Thank you. I think I would advise the people that are going to be talking about this that they want to come up with a definitive answer. And even though I'm a chiropractor, I understand the issue. But the liability issue is a big one. And in terms of You know, some of us, I'm a co-author on the bill because I support the idea. There's a zillion details which have to be worked out and must be worked out. But I want to encourage I don't think you're on sides. I think you all represent a little different concerns. But I think that doing nothing is not an answer that I'm comfortable with, and I think that this body is comfortable with, where the so many are unable to be of service, you simply have to work way below cost to provide the services, and here's a possibility of something. In the whole healthcare cost, if you didn't notice, we're working at a lot this year, and it's on our mind. And so this may well be part of the answer. I was told by some of the audience that this has gone well in New Zealand and Canada for decades, and they worked out some of the bugs there. I have a question, just a... I don't know if it matters now, but on the bill, on line 114 of the amendment, it says, they'll talk with the advisory committee, it says any public university. It doesn't address if you happen to have a private school or if you had some other one, and you may rather, I don't need to do it now, but I think later you might want to say any institution or something. Because if you have a private dental school, are there those? I don't know. If you had one somewhere that was doing this, they'd want them to have the same kind of strong program. Do you know about that,
Representative Abra, members, I know that there are a lot of details that need to be fleshed out. And I, you know, with those two concerns you just brought up, I'm committed, I'm going to commit to the committee that as this move forward, we're going to continue to discuss with all sides before it gets to the next committee and the floor. This is not, by far, it's not a done deal. And so we're going to move, as we move forward, we'll have continued this discussion. So,
and I just have one more question, Madam Chair. And actually, to that point, and I'm giving these things just as items to work on. I happen to be have the privilege of co-chairing a working group with Senator Lynch. And this got a very brief review. There wasn't really a debate there. And I apologize for that. It was just a mention of this, and it kind of got us all spurred to the idea. Although I did talk on the sidelines to every interested party and said, this is a good time to work on this. I would suggest you get onto it. Then it was approved later by the Healthcare Access Commission. And I reiterated to a few of the sideline observers who were deeply interested. Can you tell me how many meetings you've had so far with each other to begin this process? So many dental people. I mean, has there been a couple? Is it going well? Are you...
Dr. O'Neill again. I guess I just would like to say that the reference was made that there was a meeting with the MDA and that the amendment, alleviates some of our concerns. We had a multitude of concerns as a very brief meeting last Friday, and I think it's a misrepresentation to say that, it's alleviated our concerns. And not at all. We've had very little meeting. We've had very little input on this. We just got the bill. And I just think it's inappropriate to be passing something that needs a lot of work and has a lot of questions and a lot of misinformation. It just seems kind of an odd way to do it.
Right, Madam Chair. Maybe if you can just, can you just describe how many meetings you've tried to have or how many you've had?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, we've had four in the last 2 months. It wasn't specifically about the bill, but talking about the model. Over the last year and a half, it's been brought up.
Name again for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just so they could hear it.
Okay. I'm Colleen Brickle. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Scott.
And who you are?
Yes.
Besides your name, the title. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Program Director of the Degree Completion and Postbaccalaureate Program at Metropolitan State and Normandale Community College. But we've met four times recently in the last 2 months, not specifically about the bill, but the practitioner was brought up. And over the past year and a half, there's been discussion before the Board of Dentistry twice. I went to the Minnesota Dental Association at one time telling the program had been approved. Not a lot of details. Plus, Association of Community Dentistry had a forum on it. So it's been out for a while.
Well, thank you, and Madam Chair, and I'll stand down after this part. sometimes, having worked with these, and this is hard. This is hard for the dentists, and the hygienists, I think, have a really meritorious idea. And keeping people in the same room working and talking is of merit. And with all respect, Doctor, sometimes when a bill is moving, people are more inclined to talk. And this is a, I want you to understand that as a person who respects the value of licensure, who likes credentials, as you heard from before, I understand the need for safety, but also the access and cost. This still's on our mind, and I hope there's a way that this can come to a reality, and so that the dentists and the hygienists, who are going to be working together, can find a way to get to an agreement about how to make this work. If no dentist hires an ADHP, then this is all for naught. And I would think, if I were a dentist, I'd want to have like four of them, and reach out into some, and really reach out, and I think it'd be a nice mentoring relationship, and if you could sleep at night, you'd get the liability stuff figured out, so. I think this is an idea that can keep moving, and I would support moving it out tonight to keep the dialogue going, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Fritz? Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a comment, really. First of all, I want to thank you, Representative Tao, for bringing this forward. And as a licensed nurse of over 40 years working in long-term health care, the nursing homes, that's my area of concern. We have a barber chair and a beauty chair, but we don't have a dentist chair. We lack dental care in our nursing homes. I have, in Faribault, if I have a patient with a dental problem, I have to send them to Blooming Prairie. They are not seen, if they're on MA, in Faribault. It's also most difficult to transport and transfer a patient, oftentimes, perhaps because of a stroke or some illness, from their wheelchair to the dentist chair, and when I have a patient that I've sent to the dentist, oftentimes they'll call and say, who's going to come along to help lift them into the chair? So we have to send staff that we don't have. So that also is an issue that bothers me. When I leave home to come up here to serve, my nursing home directors of nurses say to me, Patty, I know you're going up there to do some good work, but please try to get us some dental care for these residents in these nursing homes. These people don't come in with dentures. They come in with very broken teeth. They need a lot of help cleaning an exam to begin with, and we do not get it. And so I'm looking forward to working on this bill. I am a co-author of it, and that's my reason. So thank you, and please work together, and let's put something forward that we can get some access to our folks down home, the elderly population. Thank you.
Madam Chair, as we come to a conclusion, I was told that the folks who will be trained under this provision will be trained by dentists themselves. So I think this education piece, it's there. It's not like they go a couple of years and we give them some tools to work on your teeth. Obviously, they're going to get trained by trained dentists who sometimes also maybe were teachers at the dental school as well. And this is a master's level program. So I think we need to keep that in mind as we move forward with this.
Go ahead.
Dr. Ling, if I could just make a little clarification. I was also a teacher at the dental school. I was a clinic instructor. I was 1 year out of school. So having taught at the dental school does not give me the credentials of a professor or an advanced educator. I have no training in education. I was a clinic instructor. And so there's a lot of terms there. The facility at the dental school, as compared to our current hygiene programs, there's a tremendous difference in some of the teaching capabilities, the sophistication of that, an instructor versus a professor versus someone who's had education training. These are some of the specifics that I think we need to address. I don't think that you can take one of the top dental schools in the world, the University of Minnesota, and say that you're going to duplicate that in a local college, and think that you're going to be on par. Yeah, I don't like those comparisons. There's a lot of words that are being used, and these are the generalities that we need to get and meet together to get to the specifics.
I now have a few questions. First of all, I'd like someone to, on the pro side, respond to this issue about the educational training in terms of whether the coursework is going to be at least at the levels of the school practice suggesting going to be equivalent or how not on the dental school education.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly the issue of the facility has been mentioned a couple times in terms of, you know, the labs or resources or facilities for it, how that will be addressed under what you're proposing.
Okay, as far as the education goes, a dental hygienist with a baccalaureate degree has 4 years of education and 600 clinical hours before they graduate. Mm-hmm. And as far as clinical facilities go, there is an agreement between Metropolitan State University and Normandale Community College to use their clinical facilities. We have simulation, we have computer technology, intraoral cameras, very state-of-the-art facilities for them to use.
I'm asking, and maybe you're not able to answer the question, the extent to which those facilities are equivalent or is of high quality to the training of these dental schools to practice is what's available at the University of Minnesota Dental School.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. I'm on the advisory board committee for the curriculum, and I think after the last meeting, with the representatives from the MDA, some of the changes were made in the legislation that I think, although I have pretty significant confidence in the curriculum and some of us are clinical professors, that by adding some external review that it will give you some assurance that the Metropolitan State University program will be held to a high standard that will produce practitioners that are capable.
Mm-hmm. And since you referred to, excuse me, I've been sick, so I'm stumbling a little bit tonight, but referred to the issues of the change of legislation, I just wanted to comment based on Dr. Lingle's comment about, I certainly didn't, and I don't, and I expect many of the rest of us did not interpret their opening comments tonight about the new language and amendment as having claimed you had, you know, passed off that you your issues have been addressed. We do enough of this to know that doesn't mean that, unless it's stated explicitly by the parties involved. And so I think we understood that those were some voluntary changes that had been offered up, but not necessarily addressing all of your issues at that time. The issue of the many of the first of all, I want to say that I appreciate Representative Abler's comments. I think that I serve on, you know, both Health and Human Service committees. We had out-state tours this summer, and also throughout last session, the issue of dental access and the issues, the things that develop that when that's not available have been made most apparent to us, particularly in our out-state tours. I think some of the most moving testimony by dentists in the out-state was stories and photographs of the result of insufficient dental access in their communities, and having, you know, tried for 3 years so to get more dentists and not being successfully do so. So I think that we do have a significantly worsening dental access problem. I think we should be looking at any and all possibilities for solving that. There's this proposal, but there's some other proposals out there to tweak other parts of the system to address that, and we should be considering all of those things. And I also am quite open to this possibility of having advanced practice nurses as one of the potential ways to address this problem. None of it's going to be a silver bullet, but in moving into that direction. Having said that, I share a number of the concerns, some of the concerns raised by Representative Norton and also some of the dentists on the opponent side here in terms of the nature of the collaborative agreement. How far it goes when I hear what is being, first of all, the issue of whether you can't always anticipate the severity of the problem encountered, and also the extension of the scope to the drugs and medications and those kinds of things. I am concerned that there is not a dentist on site. Where I've used nurse practitioners and physician assistants in my life, there's usually a clinical setting when there's also physicians in that clinical setting. So there's a variety of people at a variety of levels. So if need be, you know, a more advanced person could be brought in for assistance with a diagnosis or treatment. And so I do think there is a serious need in moving forward with this that the parties work on that if it does move forward tonight. I also, and this has not been addressed yet, it was talked about, I believe, in the Dean's statement, but not addressed by the others yet, this issue of, I certainly heard about it in emails and through other communications, of the type of exam and whether it was going to be a third-party exam by an independent agency type of situation.
And on that point, I'd like the those in support of this legislation to respond on that particular point about the exam and, well, both of those points, the extent to which this collaborative agreement really protects the patient and also can handle those more difficult situations when they crop up, and secondly, this issue of the type of exam involved and why we're not moving to a third-party independent type, as is true currently with the other hygienists and also dentist practice. Who wants to take that one?
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amos. I'm sitting here, so we did have some discussion around that one. Dentistry is kind of unique in the way it examines its practitioners before they go into practice. You know, I've never, part of my job involves supervising physicians, and no surgeon has ever had to demonstrate that they know how to take out an appendix on a patient to an outside board before the state licensure board grants them their license. For this position, we did, based on the discussion, even though there was no agreement, we did add to the legislation that the practitioner would need to pass an exam approved by the Board of Dentistry, but we did insert language that mean that must be part of their educational program, and not which from my perspective means not an external board. I can give you my personal opinion that the external board review, as we dentists go through it, has limited value as an assessment of expertise when you have competent practitioners graduating from competent accredited dental institutions. To put that additional piece of testing there is less than useful resources, I think.
Let me see if I understood that clearly. So you're saying that it is now going to be an exam certified by the Board of Dentistry, but it would not be an outside. Is that what you're saying?
What the legislation said is that they must pass, that they have to pass a test approved by the board.
But which board is what I meant?
The Board of Dentistry.
Okay, it is the Board of Dentistry.
Yes.
I think that's not what I'd understood several days ago.
And it must,
okay.
But it must be
okay.
Part of their educational program.
Okay.
Not
okay.
An add-on with some third party.
And would either of you like to address the issue of the collaborative agreement and my concerns, and I think shared by a few others, about whether... Go ahead, Dr. Langer.
Dr. Langer, I'm just reading this amendment in Subdivision 4, and it does not say anything about being approved by the Board of Dentistry. It says you've got a committee that shall include dentist, hygienist, representatives of the board, and then pending the development of a national accreditation capability, the committee shall develop a process for external review.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of our big concerns, is that we have a Board of Dentistry, but that's not what the original bill said, and that's not what I'm reading in the amendments either.
Go ahead. Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. That language relates to the curriculum development.
Yeah.
The language related to the exam is on page 4, line 13.
Mm-hmm.
After the word with, we insert the word and approved by the board, and we delete the may and insert the must be part of the, which is be part of the.
Yeah, I wasn't seeing exam anywhere in this one either. So.
Pardon?
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't seeing exam in here either, so I was questioning if this would be a perfect spot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and to the issue of the collaborative agreement and our concerns about not whether a dentist should be present in a larger clinical setting.
Colleen Brickle,
mm-hmm.
Madam Chair of the Committee. Under the collaborative management agreement, that's right, there would not be a dentist on site. But such as, like, is happening, I'm giving an example, in Alaska, they do have teledentistry that they use a lot, that they can communicate that way.
Mm-hmm.
You can send a digital radiography, an intraoral camera. You can have communication that way. So, again, it would be specified what clinical protocols that the dentist determines they feel comfortable with out of the duties that are assigned that would be performed. And that really would vary from one collaborative management agreement to another, depending upon that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to comment on that, the example from the earlier testimony by Ms. Cozart with Sharon and Caring and also going across the street, which I found very moving and very a great contribution to this conversation. In those two settings, I wouldn't think if, you know, if she was in a dance practice, she wouldn't have, tele mechanisms, photographic video mechanisms for, transferring this information back and forth at that time. And therefore, if a problem did occur and there wasn't, a dentist available other than by phone, that would be my concern. So it's not clear to me that all settings where this would occur would have that capability in the near future or even longer term.
Madam Chair, committee, I know also that within the curriculum, which will be merged, is emergency care, again, emergency management, and again, referral systems. And with the guidelines that they're given, we would hope, like the majority, you wouldn't attempt something that you couldn't, that could happen, but there will be what any dentist would possibly do if they have one in their office, a 911 or emergency code. But this will be covered in the curriculum.
Patrick Lloyd, the University of Minnesota. Just as a point of clarification further, as I mentioned earlier, it's important as the dean of the dental school that all members of the team are trained in such a way that our students feel confident upon graduation to work with them. It's critical to the maintenance of our relationship with the assistants, the hygienists, the laboratory technologists, that the same systems are used to evaluate competency, to establish standards of accreditation that are uniform and acceptable, conducted by third parties that represent the entire needs of the community, state of Minnesota, the Midwest, and the United States. Mm-hmm. For me to be able to work with our students to participate fully with this new team member, we need to see some of those relationships develop that we discussed this evening. As I said in my closing remarks, we stand ready to have those kind of conversations to establish criteria for evaluation and standardization for review.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I think as we move to a close here, I still am committed to making sure that we work with all sides on this matter. I had this bill scheduled, and I'm surprised for the amount of time I had not had one dentist or one person come to my office other than a lobbyist who came and basically said they're opposed to the bill and didn't really give me any other reason. So my door is still open. I'm a nice guy. I think I know that there are issues in here that we could work with, but I think it's important that we move forward with this proposal to make sure that we get some access.
I know that people probably were interested in this recommendation. I have one quick question again to the dean, and then we'll move towards closing here. Since you have both types of students, dental and four-year hygienist, I believe, that you stated earlier, could, given the testimony of the two dental students that you brought along with you today, or that are here today, which I, by the way, love to commend you for willing to going back to outstate Minnesota and up north when you're done. I hope you stick to that. We'd be thrilled to see that. The difference in the science, the courses that the pre-dental student is taking in the science area versus what a four-year dental, a dental hygienist would have in your program.
Our requirements look to have students apply to our program who've taken pre-dental courses. Oftentimes these are the same courses pre-medical students take. Mm-hmm. They tend to be at a higher caliber. They tend to be basic science courses in physics and organic chemistry and chemistry that are intended to prepare students for professional programs, mm-hmm. and not for undergraduate programs. Mm-hmm. So they're, as a rule, they're different. I know oftentimes when we have applicants who are hygienists, previously they had to go back and take a different type of chemistry course, whether it's organic or basic physics, mm-hmm. a different type of course to get there. It doesn't mean they can't, it just means that the course requirements are what I classify as being basic science intense.
Mm-hmm. And those of you that are creating the new master's program and designing it, the prerequisites for that, would they alter the kind of science courses that currently four-year hygienists? I'm going to say, or is that been discussed explicitly?
Madam Chair, Committee, Colleen Brickle. No, we're not going to alter it at that point with their experience and what they've had. We're going to keep what we have. Thank you.
This is a further comment. Our average student right now is going into dental school with 4.5 years of college, some as high as 10, depending upon previous careers. They may have been a basic scientist, they may have been an academic or another institution, but our standards continue to climb higher every year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wingle? I think one other comment, when you're comparing a two-year curriculum to a four-year dental school curriculum, the number of credits that a dental student carries is really about 150% of the average credit load that a college student would have. So you're literally packing 6 years of college into a four-year dental school curriculum. And so, you know, we have a lot of concerns about the curriculum, is that you're not necessarily, you know, from what we are seeing, getting half of dental school. You know, you may be getting a third of that. And so it's a lot of material to pack in, and that's where the curriculum needs to be evaluated. Again, I think by a third party.
Okay. Thank you. And Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair, thank you. As long as we're comparing, I think we should probably be a little bit more aware of the dental hygiene clinical experiences. Particularly in our program, we have 3 years of clinical experience, and I know the dental students start in their third year. We have in this bill required at a minimum 2,400 hours, which translates to 2 years of clinical experience. And if you couple that with two more years of clinical experience, you come out with 8 years of clinical experience in the oral cavity. I'm not saying doing fillings, but in the oral cavity with good, strong clinical skills. And Melissa is a 20-year hygienist going into the program. So I propose that the advanced dental hygiene practitioner upon program completion has equal or better intraoral skills, not filling skills, than the new dentist graduate. So have had more experience clinically at that point. Mm-hmm. If you factor in, too, that parts of the dental curriculum include dental hygiene scope of practice, local anesthesia, nitrous oxide, preventive therapies, if you were to take that out of the dental curriculum, that would leave that program at a shorter length, too. So, I mean, if we're talking about comparison, we could go beyond what you're hearing tonight.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to ask Griffin Towns just to renew his motion, but I'd like to make one further comment, is that we've alluded to earlier in the evening that we're always happy in this committee when we see people work together productively and preferably over a good period of time to work out some of these issues. It was talked about earlier about the meetings that have occurred, and I have a document here that states the dates of all the meetings and what happened. But this document also indicates that the actual language of this bill was discussed for the first time on Friday, and that is a great concern to me. And I think in general, as process, it's a great concern to me. And as I've stated earlier, I think this is an idea that's absolutely worth considering as part of the solution here. But given both the issue of the degree to which the two sides have had the language in front of them, and also the concerns I raised in my early remarks, that I'm going to have Representative Howe renew his motion in a moment, but I personally would prefer that this stay in this committee for further discussion. But I'm now going to ask Representative Howe to renew his motion.
Members, we still got a long ways to go, so I renew my motion that with recommendation for House File 3247 to pass as amended to Health Human Service policy.
On Representative Howe's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion, Representative Howe's motion passes.
Thank you. You could adjourn.
We now adjourn the meeting. Thank you for your patience tonight.